So if people sit at the back, I just take exception because we always appreciate that people must be quite close. So when I was a teacher, I would even retract some marks for sitting at the back to encourage my students to come closer. So the assessment must be quite intense. We are meeting today sequel to a number of meetings that we have had as a committee. So part of the decisions we have taken as a committee informs the agenda we have today. So there is an agenda before you. We had had discussions with the portfolio committee and the management of the department. So what was flagged highly was the issue of the CETA, which I think will constitute bulk of our time today. I would like to, although I will allow them to introduce themselves, the Minister of Communication and Telecommunications. So it has been reconfigured differently in the sixth parliament. She will just correct us in that line. And also welcome the Deputy Minister of Home Affairs, who is also standing here for the minister. So we'd like to welcome all of you. The agenda is as circulated. I wonder if there's anyone who want to members to subtract or make an addition on the issues that are there on the agenda, but it is as it is prepared, and we also welcome members. We also welcome members from CETA. We also welcome members of the media who are here today. Without the wasting much more time, I take it that we are agreeing with the agenda as it is. We will take a round of introduction so that we exactly know who exactly is in the house. I did get this advice also from Honorable McClover, who said people in a meeting must be known who are they and where do they come from. So we'll just take a quick round of introduction. We'll start with members. From members, who will come to decide where the minister, the honorable minister, and the deputy minister are sitting. We'll start from your veteran Legod.
And my name is Masiwa Legod. I'm a member of this committee. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. My name is Musa Chavan. I'm a member of this committee.
Good morning. My name is Angel Kanyile. I'm a member of this portfolio committee. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Adrian Rose. I'm an alternate member of the committee.
Good morning. My name is Joe McGlua, coming from a very warm northwest province, a member of this committee.
Morning, colleagues. My name is Didi Malolo Fase, a member of this portfolio committee.
Jabulo Mzuza, I'm the Deputy Minister for Home Affairs.
Morning, colleagues. My name is Delanda Beni Abrahams, the Minister responsible for Communications and Digital Technologies.
Honorable members and colleagues, my name is Thulani Mavuso. I'm the Acting Director General of Home Affairs.
Chairperson, honorable members, my name is Gordon Olympia. I'm the CFO at Home Affairs.
Good morning, Chair, Ministers, and Honourable Members. My name is Ntutule Tsenye, and I'm the Acting CEO at CETA.
Good morning, Chair, Ministers, and Honourable Members. My name is Musa Khumalo. I am the Acting Head of Department, Networks at CETA.
Good morning, Chair, and everyone. My name is Lorato Tito, the member of this committee. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Liesel van der Merwe, a member of this committee.
Yeah, morning, Chair. Frank Makua, parliamentary officer, officer of the minute.
They can't hear what you...
Morning, Chair. Frank Makua, parliamentary officer. Office of the Minister of Home Affairs.
Good morning, Chair and colleagues. My name is Kaya Gazi Dasi. I'm the Technical Advisor and Officer of the Deputy Minister.
Good morning, Chairperson, Minister, Deputy Minister, colleagues. And my name is Dion Erasmus. I'm the Chief Director, Legal Services and Home Affairs.
Good morning, Honourable Chair, Minister, Deputy Minister, members. I'm Tanya Abraham, Parliamentary Liaison for CETA.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Pamela Tabaza. I'm the Senior Manager in Customer Services at CETA.
Good morning, Chair, members, Minister and Deputy Minister, colleagues. My name is Ntabile Mukitimitlamini. I'm in the office of the Minister. I'm the spokesperson.
Good morning, Chair, Minister, Deputy Minister. My name is Sabiro Sibisi. I'm the Private Secretary, Deputy Minister of Home Affairs.
Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members. My name is Tulani Ngubane, Head of Office in the Office of the Deputy Minister of Home Affairs.
Good morning, Chair, Deputy Minister and the Minister. My name is Senzo Zondi, Parliamentary Officer in the Office of the Deputy Minister of Home Affairs.
Morning, Chairperson. My name is Mahumara Lehlakudi, Parliamentary Capital Support, Department of Home Affairs.
Can you really introduce yourself for record purposes?
Mahumara Lehlakudi, Parliamentary and Cabinet Support, Home Affairs.
Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members of this August Parliament, colleagues in Government. My name is Simpiwe Shope, Chief Director, IT Infrastructure Management at Home Affairs.
Morning, Chair. Morning, Committee. Morning, Ministers. My name is Tandi Gangogo. I'm the Chief Director, Supply Chain Management at Home Affairs. Thank you.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, Members. I'm Richard Stoltz. I'm the Chief Director, Immigration Support.
Morning. I'm CSO Civil Major, Director, Drafting Legal Services of Home Affairs. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair and Members of the Committee, Honourable Ministers. My name is Riaz Musa. I'm with Intergovernmental Relations at the Department of Home Affairs.
Good morning. My name is Julia Bazzi. I'm a volunteer for Scalabrini Center.
Morning, Minister, Deputy Minister and Members. I'm Siyabonga Mkhonazi from Independent Media.
Good morning, Vuvani Mthembu from DCPS.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Minister and Deputy. My name is Siya Koza from the Ministry of Home Affairs. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Nandi Amaqegwana, Committee Assistant for the Committee.
Good morning. My name is Batanda Mlambo from Office of Minister Ndabeni Abrahams. Thank you.
Good morning, members, ministers. My name is Chabiso Tugani from the Office of the Minister of Communications and Digital Technologies.
Morning, Chair. Good morning, members and Minister and Deputy Minister. My name is Rendani Mseta from the Department of Telecommunication and Postal Services, Chief Director, SOC Oversight.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Ministers. Good morning, members. My name is Talib Sadiq. I'm a Director at CETA.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Minister. Good morning, Deputy Minister. Good morning, members. My name is Dr. Karisti Kavulo, a monitor from PMG.
Good morning. My name is Edma Tonsi. I'm the committee secretary.
Yeah, thank you very much. Can we entertain apologies?
Good morning again. From the committee members, I don't have any apologies. I've got only two apologies from the chairperson of CETA. I'm sure they've made that apology as well. There's a letter and also an apology from the Minister of Home Affairs.
Honorable Chairman.
There's one apology, Chair, for Honorable Muyala. He's engaged in examination.
Any other apology? None. Thank you very much, Deputy Minister.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you, Chair. There is an apology from the Minister, Home Affairs. He is in a study. They are in a tour to China. Yes. Thank you.
I think that is double apology because it was read on record. Yeah, thank you very much. We are going to allow the lead department, which is Home Affairs, to start with the presentation. And then thereafter, they will give us direction, and later we'll give the Minister of Communications to lead us with the team. And over to you, Home Affairs.
Thank you very much, Chair, and members of the committee. We have prepared a presentation that deals with item 3 and 4 on the agenda, which has to do with the issues of connectivity. Just to bring a bit of background before I hand over to the DG to present the technical presentation, is that Home Affairs by its design is a largely IT-dependent department that has a lot of dependency on CETA for its technology use. Most of our offices, for them to be operational at all times, it really requires us to have both networks and our systems operating at all times. Therefore, any downtimes that might have been seen or observed in the past will have obviously been based on two reasons, which one will be network failures or power failures or the failure of our systems. We have met with the Department of Communications and CETA to deal with the issues, and will also propose solutions on how we are going to work forward. We are going to work moving forward. We will also highlight some areas where our cooperation has yielded some results, more especially with our mobile trucks. I will then hand over to the DG to deal with the issue of the technical presentation and detail on the matter. If there are any other areas that might be left, we'll then assist the DG. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members. Chair and members, when we presented the annual report of 2018-19 financial year, I think there are a number of challenges that we reported in that particular presentation. One of those, obvious, was the issue regarding the downtime that we experienced in our offices on a regular basis, which I recall that last year, for an example, there was a period where we experienced downtime for a longer period. And I think this presentation, obviously, is as a result of that particular presentation, but also as a result of previous reports that we have brought to the committee around network issues. So having said that, we therefore prepared a presentation that will deal with some of the issues that emanated from that annual report presentation. So I will deal with just the background and the current situation that we face with, and what progress we have made regarding network connectivity and issues relating to IT infrastructure like data centers, and some of the challenges that we face with through the procurement and challenges with SETA, and the key one being the report that we made to the committee during the annual report around the possible irregular expenditure under investigation, and we want to indicate some of those areas regarding the audit failures on the ABIS procurement. Chair and members, in terms of the legislation, in particular the SETA Act, there are certain prescribed mandatory and non-mandatory services that government departments need to get from SETA. And those mandatory services prescribed by the legislation, one of those is, actually three of those is the provision of telecommunication networks services, which we get through SETA, is the hosting of data centers for all government systems, and then the provision of transversal services of government, for example, the bus, PESAL and LOGIS. So those are some of the mandatory services that we get from SETA. Obviously, there's logic around the centralized hosting of government systems, and I'm not going to talk to that. I think SETA will raise those issues. And what are the services that we currently get from SETA? As I've indicated, the hosting services, where we're hosting the National Population Register, the movement control system, the bus system for our finance, PESAL and LOGIS systems. And these SETA host both our production and disaster recovery sites for those particular services. And then also there are what we call housing services. This, for example, the HANIS, the database for biometrics is hosted, the DR is hosted at SETA. The service management, which we use for live capture for smiting and passports, is also housed at SETA. Also, the dedicated virtual private network, remote access dial-up services, VPNC services, and also what we call the SMS check and trace facility. This is when someone has applied for a document, obviously, you know, they get an SMS indicating that where your application has been received, or you can come collect. That's a SMS service we're talking about. And also the batch printing for documents like your salary advices and green ID books. So that's basically some of the services that SETA renders to the department. Now, Chair, as an indication is that we have been having, in terms of the background, network issues, which we have reported to SETA and the Minister for Telecommunications and Postal Services since 2013-14 financial year. I wish to indicate that in 2013 is when we started with the first production of SmartCard on the 18th of July 2013. And post that, there's been obvious huge challenges, because prior to 2013, people were being serviced through paper forms. They drop application forms at offices, and obviously there were no issues relating to network connectivity. But the post 18 July 2013, we required the network availability was high up on the agenda to ensure that the systems are always up and running. That's when obviously we started experiencing some of these challenges. So I've just indicated some of the timelines relating to some of the activities that we have had with SETA. There were various meetings between the then DG and the then CEOs of SETA from 2013, because there was quite a number of changes prior to before the current acting CEO. And then the ministerial letters between our Minister of Home Affairs and Minister of Telecommunications since 2014, whose letters I think we would have to avail to the committee at some point where if it's required. There were a number of intervention meetings again between ourselves and the telecommunications. There were ministerial interventions at the time. Minister Kwele was the Minister of DTPS and the Minister Kigabe at the time. That the matter ended up being elevated to cabinet for discussion. And then obviously cabinet had instructed that both ministers find a solution to the matter. This committee called for a joint committee meeting with the DTPS Portfolio Committee in September 2016, where both ourselves and SETA were asked to come to front of the committee to explain some of these challenges. And I will then indicate what happened prior to sort of post that particular meeting. Chair and members, the current situation is that the Department of Home Affairs Live Capture System fully rely on network availability in all 193 offices and 15 bank sites that offer live capture. I must emphasize that the other remaining offices, because when you look at the total number of offices, sitting with 412 offices and 15 bank sites, then that excludes obvious other sites that consume, like your head office, like your refugee centers and so forth. The network disruption for us, it causes huge service delivery downtime in front offices, which obviously that is being categorized as a denial of service, because citizens go to our offices, if the network is down, obviously they have to go back because they have not been able to be serviced. Because in the past, obviously, if the network is down, perhaps a person will drop a form there and then leave. But the reason why we move to this digital environment is to ensure that a person, when they leave the office, they are guaranteed that they've been serviced. Because when you drop a form, you do not know when the form leaves the office for capturing in head office. Sometimes it leaves after a week. That is why we're even in the missions abroad, where people apply current passports and the missions abroad, they still fill in the forms, because we have not, those missions are not digitally connected to us. And it takes very long time. The diplomatic bag would leave after a month sometime, while a person says, I applied on the 1st of July, only find that the diplomatic bag only gets to Pretoria late in August. So those are some of the challenges that we're faced with. But when a person leaves the office now, when they get that SMS before they get to the car, they are guaranteed that the service has been rendered. So therefore, the issue of network availability becomes quite crucial for us. We are currently hosting our movement control systems at ports of entry on the SARS network. And again, as a bit of background, is that in 2010, when the movement control system was designed for the purposes of the World Cup, because we had to give guarantees to FIFA at the time, we were working with SARS on that particular activity and the development of the system. And the decision was taken at the time that we were going to be hosting in the same environment. And that particular, obviously, hosting has guaranteed us less service disruptions. Actually, I must say that we're getting about 99.9 network availability in that environment. It was just only in one incident recently where there was power issue at Edward Tambo for a period of like 50 minutes. This was the only time in my last 6 years since I joined the department that that particular port experienced a downtime. So the dilemma that we currently face is that we are now, obviously, with the e-visa that has been being piloted and the new biometric systems, which has to be deployed into the current CETA network before the end of the current financial year, obviously, need to ensure that we are not going to have a situation where someone arrives at the port of entry and obviously the network is down, because that's in one area that is very sensitive, particularly when it comes to travelers, both South Africans and those who are coming abroad, because that's the first interface that they have with the country. Chairperson and members, the current situation or the state of the wide area network infrastructure is that the core network of CETA transmit data from offices for processing to CETA, and then obviously connects through the switching centers of CETA, and that the Home Affairs connects to all offices through the 11 switching centers of CETA across the country. That's what is depicted in that particular picture, which is a sort of a cloud picture. So the network switching centers is also powered by normal municipal power most of the time. And they are obviously that the CETA provides what we call an alternative power supply. UPS is a generator to ensure that when the municipal power is down, they're able to switch on the alternative power to ensure. Because if, for example, one switching center, let's say in Pietermaritzburg, if it goes down, it affects all the offices in that particular area. The whole Durban area, KZN in particular, at large, gets affected. Only to find that other provinces are working, but it's just one switching center. But the biggest issue, obviously, which we'll talk about, is that all these switching centers, they terminate at CETA Centurion, which is an issue that we need to discuss, because at the last time when we were here in 2016, we raised the very same issue that if we were to create dual lanes, for an example, in order to create the redundancy, those switching centers must not terminate at the same place, because obviously it does not help us that if CETA Centurion has issues, therefore if you terminate in the same place, then you're not going to get the benefit out of it. So we're saying that if the switching center loses power or suffer any technical challenge, therefore the network in that part of the country will be affected. And then the infrastructure, obviously, is also another main cause of the service delivery disruption, as there's no redundancy in the last mile connecting to the offices. And that's something that I think we've been dealing with our colleagues. So what we have done thus far is that after that 2016 meeting, there was an agreement which we regarded as a compromise, because when we came here, it was clear that at the time the minister had made it very clear that we're seeking an exemption from the utilization of CTS services. So as a compromise out of that meeting the exemption, CTS indicated that they were going to be able to give us the same network design that we are currently getting from the movement control system, which is sitting on the SARS network. The SARS network is actually powered by a IS solution of dimension data. So there was a trilateral agreement that for the management of the DHA network. CTA then went out to draft a specification to invite bid proposals for management of Home Affairs network. And we participated, obviously, in the evaluation process of that bid. And then Dimension Data was recommended as an appointed successful bidder. There was a contract that was entered into between CTA and Dimension Data. But because we sought visibility on what was going to happen, we said that post that we need to have a trilateral memorandum of understanding, because we wanted to be part and parcel of what was being discussed between the two parties and in terms of our network assessment. So we brought in our team, we signed a trilateral agreement, and that I think was a very good decision that we made. Post that signing of the trilateral agreement, then there was a network assessment that was conducted by Dimension Data in order to establish what are the really sore points that cause network failures from time to time. There were various issues that were raised in that assessment, but two major ones was power and telecom data lines, which were the leading cause of network outages. As I cited an example to say, when a switching center loses power or telecom cables are being stolen by thieves, I must indicate that most of the telecom lines are still copper lines, which is obvious vulnerable to theft. That represents about 88% of our offices still connected through DigiNet. So if those lines get stolen, you know, then we have a problem. So I think we're trying to ensure that we move to obvious fiber, because we found that actually fiber is not useful for any criminal activities. So therefore, it would be good that we move to fiber and ensure that we deal with those issues. The second issue that we found was that the network assessment also identified some of the network devices which were obsolete, and recommendation regarding the refresh were made. Some of those devices belong to us as the Department of Home Affairs, so what we needed to be able to refresh. Post the assessment, then there was a strategy that was developed and the investment plan to ensure that we achieve our goal of having uninterrupted networks. The plan was obviously developed by Dimension Data as part of their scope of work that was given to them. It was then recommended to us by CETA for approval. The plan sought Home Affairs to invest, I think in the region, just over about 200 million rand for us to be able to fix the network issues. We conditionally approved the strategy as the ex-co of the department, but we wanted to subject it to an expert in the review, because we thought this is a huge investment. We also want to ensure that whatever investment we make, it will yield the desired outcome. So we did receive the independent review, which questioned some of the issues. For an example, our service level agreement currently with CETA is at a bronze level. And I think maybe when my colleague makes this presentation, he'll be able to depict that. And the recommendation was that we move some of the offices to gold and platinum for selected offices, particularly the high volume offices, where we can be able to get 99.9 service level availability. Well, the network average for the bronze is currently at just below 96%. But some of the assessment, obvious, you know, when we are discussing with CETA, they have indicated a certain period where that 96% is where is exceeded. And then furthermore, there was a proposed, new networking called software-defined networking, which was found at the time by the aspects to say it was going to be inappropriate for DHA, as the technology support is not matured yet, and that the proposed investment plan requires, obviously, the Home Affairs to invest in this SDN equipment, rendering obvious the current technology refresh that we are dealing with unnecessary, when obvious those that technology refresh can actually last us for the next 5 to 7 years without being replaced. So there's still a debate around this particular area, which obvious once we find each other, we'll be able to brief the committee in terms of how we're going to take the issue forward. Also, the proposed strategy did not address what we call the CETA core network and the switching centers issue, which I raised earlier. The omission of these two important network layers for us, which did not form part of the scope that was awarded to Dimension Day. So in the presentation to the Portfolio Committee in 2016, CETA committed to overhaul its core network and distribution centers. And that's something I think we need to be able to address, because our view is that CETA is servicing the whole of government, not only the Department of Home Affairs. So the issue of overhauling the entire core network is quite crucial for the benefit of the entire state rather than just for the Department of Home Affairs. And that obviously our contribution as a user should be at the level of a user rather than to be the owner of the core network, because CETA obviously that's a responsibility that they have. We also want to indicate that the outages of the network, obviously in certain instances, may not occur frequently on the core or in switching network layers, but when they do occur, they're quite disastrous for us, you know, in terms of denial of services. That's why we talk about the 99.9 network availability. So Jay, that's basically where we are when it comes to network, but the issue around the investment plan and the strategy, we're still discussing it so that we clear some of the issues that were raised by the independent expert. And I think we will be able to clear those issues and agree how to move forward. And once that has been done, I think we'll get the desired outcome between ourselves and CETA. Chair, I just want to raise a few issues also relating to procurement delays and some of the challenges. Now, the new or what also the new technology systems, they require that when they are hosted, they must be hosted in data centers that meet some of the certain standards. For an example, data centers are categorized in four. We know now we are moving to tier five data centers, but tier one, tier two, tier three, and tier four data centers. The tier three data center that we want is that it's a data center that has got certain capabilities. For an example, there's dual networks, there's dual power supply. In other words, it's a data center that must always have, you know, 100% uptime. So it must even be certified by the Uptime Institute to ensure that there is no period where the data center could be found to be down. So in 2014, when we wanted to ensure that CETA gives us that particular service, the then CEO contracted Telkom Tier 3 data center to host, for example, some of our disaster recovery sites, and indicated that within a period of 3 years, CETA would have built and operated its own data center, Tier 3 data center. So between 2014 and 2016, the plans, obvious, for the Tier 3 data center were not formally shared with us, so we're still in the dark in relation to that. But when we went to contract for ABIS development, the automated biometric identification system, one of the requirements for ABIS was that we needed to have a Tier 3 data center, because it without a Tier 3 data center, we're not going to be able to operate that system. So it was during that period where CETA came to the party and said, look, we're not ready, we don't have the Tier 3 data center. So we'll take you again to the Telkom data centers where you're going to be able to host this particular system in those data centers. And then at this point in time, obviously, we were informed that the plan for the construction of data center is still in the draft format. It's yet to be finalized by CETA executive at the board. So that's one of the areas that we're struggling with, because, as I said, at this day and age, systems have got to be hosted in a data center that is rated as a tier 3 data center. Then the other issue relating to procurement, we've come to the committee, I think, several times around the issue of mobile units, hospital connectivity, and connectivity in ports of entry, particularly some ports that are in remote areas. We started the process of requesting for connectivity in these particular areas because, Che, when we had the old generation mobile units, our mobile units in the main were providing green ID books, the old, then the birth certificates and so forth. Now, as we move towards smart ID books, smart card, we had to decommission those particular trucks because we do not want to continue utilizing them for green ID books while we know that we are migrating away from that. So we refurbished those trucks, we bought new ones. As we have reported previously to the committee, we've got hundreds of those units now that are ready so that we can deploy them. The biggest issue was now connectivity. And again, that connectivity was one of the mandatory services that we needed to get through CETA, not to do it on our own. So the process took long for CETA to go out to the market, to look for a service provider to connect those particular trucks. And obviously, there was even mounting pressure on us, even I remember last year, even prior to the elections, that, you know, we needed to ensure that we service the communities. Unfortunately, we could not, you know, deviate from the requirement that CETA must provide that particular mandatory services. I'm glad to say that, Chair and members, that matter has now been laid to rest. After much delays, CETA has been able to finalize the contract, with a service provider who is MTN. We are now connecting those trucks. They are working robustly, and even in rural areas. We're testing them. Last week, we were in Klabuya Lingana, trying to ensure that even in the remote of the remote, those trucks are able to work. So the process is now moving. You know, we are, as I've indicated to this committee, when I came to present the annual report, that the first quarter report, that by the end of this financial year, all the 100 trucks will be connected. And we are on track with CETA on that particular one. The second one was around the network cabling in offices. Again, there was a lengthy process that we had to follow in the cabling contract that CETA again needs to provide to the department. This is the cabling of offices to ensure that an office can be able to operate. We've got certain offices that have been ready for some time for us to be able to connect so that they operate. But obviously, CETA has to follow a process in relation to awarding that particular contract, to service providers. I mean, South Africa has got a lot of service providers in this particular space. I guess then CETA will talk to the reasons, obviously, of some of the delays that have been caused in order to finalize this. We do have about three provinces where they were able to partially award the contract in 2018 to Gauteng, Northwest, and in the Eastern Cape. But other provinces are still struggling in relation to that. So it's been a period of about 24 months with some of the delays. We try to mitigate against the delays, with the CETA CM processes by saying that, look, as a temporary solution, if they were to exempt us for this and then we go and do it on a quotation basis. So we advise that rather than do it ourselves, we'll rather at least do it through a CETA CM process. Because if we do it ourselves as Home Affairs through the quotation system, we run a risk of having that expenditure classified as irregular. Again, this just points to an issue relating how irregular expenditure sometimes is incurred. It's not a deliberate act, of trying to do or circumvent certain processes, but as a user, when you're sitting with a client that you require a service, and you, in the middle, is yourself and the mandatory service that you must get from an organization like CETA. You have to make choices whether you are going to argue and say, I'm still waiting for CETA to complete its processes, or you take a different route. And then, obviously, when it comes to AG, that is declared as irregular, and then, obviously, your books get tainted by that. So you sometimes find yourself being caught between a rock and a hard place. The last point I want to raise is relates to the ABIS procurement. Again, when the AG presented to the committee, they indicated that there is a potential or possible irregular expenditure on the ABIS contract, which was awarded to EOH for the design of ABIS, which was for a period of 6 months. Again, the department had followed the CETA Act, which gives the mandate of procurement of information technology goods and services to CETA as a procurement agency. During the audit in 1819, the AG had found that this contract to develop ABIS was awarded irregularly. This conclusion was based on the findings which had been issued by the AG to CETA, which obviously CETA could not resolve. Again, I must emphasize that the audit was done on the CETA side, and then the AG said if this matter can, but the issue is that the expenditure obviously was incurred on the department side. So when there's irregular expenditure, then it comes to the books of the department. That is why then during the audit findings, so the audit period, we then obviously worked with both CETA and the AG. The biggest issue that the AG raised was the limitation of scope on the accreditation process, because the ABIS process or the contracting were followed two phases. There was phase one, where there was an accreditation of bidders, and then there was phase two, where there was a procurement, now closed procurement, of those bidders that were accredited. What the AG raised is that they could not get a master file from CETA containing all documents relating to the specification, advertisement, and evaluation of bids. And also they raised an issue that the EOH audited financial statements were not in the EOH bid submission file, which was submitted to the auditors for audit, and that CETA could not provide this even after the request by the AG and the department. So based on the above, therefore, the AG could not confirm that the accreditation process of phase one was transparent, fair, and during the accreditation phase. I must emphasize that during that particular audit, we then, obviously, as department, worked jointly with CETA. We put together a complete master file document so that we can be able to give to the AG based on the copies that were given to us, you know, during the particular period. Because the original copies, obviously, when you do this procurement sit with CETA, we only just get the copies, but we were able to compile the master file, you know, that the AG wanted to the satisfaction of the AG in that regard. So that was one thing that we were able to tick, but we just wanted to highlight the challenges we face, and I think CETA maybe can talk to that, what led to that situation. Then, post the award, there was another issue that was raised by the AG. Again, there was a limitation of scope on the issue of the proposal in the awarding phase. The limitation of scope relating to security clearance for Ernst & Young, that was one issue, because the AG, CETA could not provide that to the AG. The second issue that the AG indicated that CETA provided them with all security reports of accredited bidders, including EOH and its subcontractors. However, they were not provided with the report of Ernst & Young, and that Ernst & Young had been accredited as a bidder during the phase one of the bidding process. However, when phase two was advertised, they did not stand on their own to submit their bid, but they came as a subcontractor to EOH. AG is of the view, obvious, that this arrangement between EOH and Ernst & Young should be further investigated, as it may be viewed as a possible collusive bidding. The department, obviously, then resolved with the AG that we will disclose, that's why when we came to the annual report, that we will disclose this possible irregular expenditure in our books as irregular expenditure under investigation. This was due to the fact that the department believed and still believed that this process, that the process followed was above board, and that if CETA can provide the necessary documents, then these findings can be resolved. We have obviously since requested CETA to provide the relevant documents to further investigate this matter, as alluded in our disclosure notes in the annual financial statement of 1819. And CETA has provided the department with some of the documents. However, most of the key documents have not been located due to various reasons, and we are working hard as part of that particular investigation to clear this matter. Of the biggest challenge was the issue of the financial statements, which also we have been able to locate. So we will obviously present it at the right time to the AG to ensure that this matter in the 1920 financial statements gets resolved. So we recommend that the committee note the presentation, the challenges faced by the department on the mandatory services of CETA, with an understanding that there is obvious cooperation between ourselves to try and resolve some of the issues that we are faced with. But it was important that we highlight those pressure points that we have in relation to this. Thank you very much, Chair and Honourable Members.
Thank you, Chair. Just lastly, I would like to indicate that we have met with the department, two departments, and we have placed solutions. Some of them have yielded results, for instance, the issue of the connectivity with regards to the trucks. And the department has also committed that they will be establishing a specific project management unit that will deal with the high-intensity users of IT that rely on CETA. But we'll now hand over to the department to deal with the CETA presentation. Thank you.
Now, TM, we are reminded that we're in Parliament. It's Mills Sherry who's giving to the department. I think we're doing item number 3 and 4, members, intertwinedly. So let's take note and want to give to you, Honorable Minister Stella Ndabeni-Abrahams. I'm sure members are taking note, and one of the issues maybe the minister will also clarify us, whether or not these sitters must still really continue to exist in their current form and so on. Because from the presentation of the DG, it's like the sitters are also a barrier for what we call service delivery processes. Over to you, Honorable Minister.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning once more, Honorable Members. Thank you for the opportunity to make the presentation in relation to the concerns that have been faced by our client departments. Indeed, what the DM and the DG have presented is what has been raised with us. I just want us to go back to 2016-2017, where if other members were here already in Parliament, they will remember that we were appearing a lot in SCOPA and the Portfolio Committee on Communications dealing with the corruption that's happening at CETA with the client departments that are involved. As that happened, and then at CETA, we then conducted an investigation with the responsible agencies, and that investigation led to some of the people being sent away, others suspended, and in the midst of that, if you listen to the DG's presentation as it takes the 2014, 2013, 2016, the agreements that were reached, and then some of those people are the ones that were involved in the process. Some of them have left the organization. You also hear from the DG the fact that there is a master file document that is missing from CETA. The team has been trying to recover, but what we have done, we have said CETA must put in measures, including cloning the computers of those employees that were involved. I did say the matter dates back. Once more, it is true that the ministers that were involved tried to attend to the matter. Hence, as I said, the people were then suspended. It is still a challenge up to date, Honourable Members. I want to be frank with yourselves. As much as CETA is an IT company, but it playing the role of being a procurement agency for the state has put us where we are today, which is why we took a conscious decision that it is high time that we remodel CETA, not to be a reseller, that's how we call them, or matinga tingis. Because right now, all they do is to procure services from people who resell other people's products. And that also talks to depriving the locals or South Africans and Africans an opportunity to showcase their innovations and be able to solve their challenges. When I talk of challenges, I talk of software development, the services that we're rendering from device to the latter services. So we had taken a decision, as President announced, that we will be remodeling CETA to be an IT company focusing on technology specifically. as part of rolling out the digital transformation service that we're rolling out as government. We're in a process of doing that. We had, as the DM has explained earlier, that having understood what is happening in terms of the challenges that we're facing with the key departments, we then took a decision with certain ministers that are involved in the process to say, let's establish an urgent PMO that must attend to this. This we do because we can't be a department that talks on the side of thriving and leading the fourth industrial revolution, whilst we are the ones that are also causing challenges to departments that are already trying to digitize their services. That talks to connectivity, but also as we talk about connectivity and other services that we render, we've got also to take into consideration the nature of connectivity and the services that we provide, that they also rely on other aspects. If we talk about electricity or power cuts, they affect the connectivity and whatever happens. As the DM mentioned earlier, if it's the application that fails, everybody says it's connectivity, because at times the people that deal or offer the services are not technical experts. Therefore, when the system is down, it's SITA. It's not whatever. Then until you pick up and try to check the other, and they say, no, we have it on our side. It's not you. It's that one that must do that. But nevertheless, we are one government, which is why the Deputy Minister emphasized that we met. And then we agreed that let's provide a solution that must then make sure that the people do not get to suffer and be deprived of the services, that the quality services that they're supposed to get. I then said I will be establishing the PMO as the DM said. But again, SITA will be taking you, honourable members, through the processes, because even as we go for procurement, as SITA procures, it's not a function that relies on SITA only. The client, as you know, has to be involved in each and every step of the process. And at times, because of certain things that are not followed, then there will be delays. But at times, we do purchase services from people who then do not deliver, at times, at the insistence of clients. And that has been happening throughout government. And these are the things that we're saying we really need to pay attention. We need a specific, dedicated team that must look into this thing so that we can unravel them and address them before our people rise against us. Because it doesn't matter who's there, but if people will not get the efficient service they expect from us, we would have failed them. And therefore, we stand here, honorable members, myself and the DM, making a commitment that the two departments, including State Security, Police and Defense, will be coming back to announce the time frames of the PMO to say by when the matters should be addressed. Until we meet, then for now we can't put the time frames. Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to hand over, with your permission, hand over to the acting CEO of SITA.
thank you very much, Honourable Minister. Thanks, Deputy Minister DG, for the presentation. I think the DG has really covered the network's issues quite adequately in terms of, you know, the challenges, where we're coming from with the challenges. But I think I think 2016, as the DG was saying, 2016 then became that turning point in terms of the networks, where we then came together to say it's important that we did something about the networks, because we cannot continue like this. And I think, as the minister was saying, you know, building on, you know, some of the legacy technologies that we are working from, all of us, including us as SITA, having to really do a lot of work. We're still working largely from your mainframes and so forth. And I'm sure we see that also at Home Affairs, where you do have some of this of these challenges of very obsolete technologies. And so on the basis of that, we then came together to say it is important that we then do this diagnosis so that we understand exactly what is the nature of the problem that we're dealing with, because then that will help us in being able to develop, you know, the future scenario, the investment plan or the strategy on how we will then make sure that we improve the services. And really, both of us driven by the importance of servicing, you know, the citizen at the end of the day. Although today the communication is between SITA and the Department of Home Affairs, but really the ultimate beneficiary that we all have to worry about is the citizen
that goes into a home affairs and cannot be able to get a service. And I think that is really what is at the nexus of that really drives the programs that that we look at. What I've prepared here is just to quickly run the honourable members through, you know, some of the diagnosis as the DG was talking about. You know, what are some of these issues, and what is then the program that we've put in place to make sure that we will then be able to turn this thing around, because it's very important that we can turn it around as quickly as possible. I think the DG has really spoken around the background in terms of what are the services that the CETA provides to the department. So I will not spend a lot of time on that. I will move on to the next slide. And I think the next slide also, honourable member, still talks to, you know, some of the background issues that the DG has spoken about. So I will not perhaps spend more time on that. But again, talking about, you know, the legacy systems that we have all inherited, that we need to be able to then develop and be able to move forward, looking into the nature of the engagement between ourselves in terms of you know, the dedicated network services versus, you know, a fully managed network service. And I think we're migrating more towards a fully managed network service so that we can consolidate and converge all the elements that the DG spoke about. You know, today there are some of the exclusions in terms of what we look at. So if you look at the applications, we're not looking at that. So we're looking at the network. But then, you know, a more acceptable scenario, we believe and we agree, would be where we are able to perhaps have a fully managed approach, where we can then be able to look at the applications that are running in there, the data centers, the databases that the applications are running from, the data centers that host this databases, and then of course the network. So it's only if you can look at the whole picture that then you are able to really see some solution in that regard. And I think the work that we do today is driving towards that, instead of perhaps just looking at one component of it, that we can look at the entire program. So just moving pretty quickly to the next slide. The next slide really starts looking into so this is the networks basically that I've just been talking about. So moving further on, then that talks to, again, adding on the plans that then came out of the diagnosis that we had done, and then of course the investment plan that we had developed. So this slide here, just in terms of the background, obviously looks into what are the areas that we cover and what are the areas that we have agreed we will exclude from the agreement between ourselves. And as I've said just now, you know, those exclusions, if you look at that bullet point number one, then we'll start looking into things like power, you know, security, the applications, as I've said, that we've left out. And we would like to be able to bring all of those into the fold so that we can then be able to deliver on that. So the DG spoke also about the bronze agreement, which looks into that 95% availability. So from a network perspective, then you then look at the delivery against that KPI, and you say, you know, we are delivering. But I think as the DG indicated, you know, the core and the switch is then, you know, are working fairly well for the most of the time. But when something happens, then it's really very big. So the impact becomes really, really huge. And that is why then, in terms of the proposals that are being put forward, is to then start looking into your software-defined networks and so forth. So that pretty much covers the background to our engagement and the work that we do. I think the DG has also spoken about, you know, the topology. Or the design of the network, the national government network that we look at. So there is the issue around the CETA Network Operations Center, which is really where we converge, you know, the monitoring, you know, of the networks. You know, when we say we are operating at this particular percentage, is because we are now looking at the dashboard that all of these operations converge to. We
just a minute. There is a point of. Can you press your mic for record purposes?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just saying that this document that we've got here is not supposed to be that document.
No, that's not. So this is slide 8, honorable member. I don't know.
Yeah, but which document? It is not the document obtained.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it is this document, but look.
Networks. Sorry, Chair.
Yeah, okay.
We'll intervene.
Okay. Veteran Lekota, Honorable Chabare will intervene.
But I don't have that
document.
Okay,
I think.
Unless he's hidden some of my documents.
Maybe. Okay, you can proceed. We'll attend to the problem. Yeah. Thank you.
No, thanks very much, Chair. So without really wasting time and perhaps even getting into more technicalities, but I thought it was important that perhaps we've got a mental picture of what the DG was talking about in terms of, you know, the DHA office. You know, the DG spoke about over 400 offices, and then the connection between the DHA office through the terrestrial access networks, and there that's where the DG was talking about largely 88% of those being linked through the copper, which obviously is susceptible to, you know, theft and all of that. And then from there you move into the light yellow or light pink area, which is now largely the CETA space. So the DG was talking about the CETA switching centers. You know, we've got obviously the POP there, but then also talking about the CETA core network, which then moves into the CETA data center, just so that you've got an idea of, you know, how this thing works. And then on top of that, the table above, if you look on the top right, then that then begins to talk to, you know, some of the infrastructure that the DG was talking about. So if you look at that, the DG was just talking now about the DigiNet lines, which are those copper lines. So you can see it's quite a sizable number of the offices that are running on that, the Telkom copper lines, about 330 of those, if you look at that table on the top right. And then, of course, followed by fiber. So you can see there's really a lot of work that is now going into making sure that we move into fiber to make sure that we start building towards this uninterruptible networks that we talk about because of the copper theft and all of that. And then, of course, you've got other modes of connectivity, you know, LTE, microwave, you know, which are in the minority. But I think the biggest issue there was just to highlight the copper links there. That is quite substantial. And every time these things are stolen, and this happens every day, then it means that you will have interrupted services there, you know, to the office itself. So we just wanted to highlight that. What we then thought we would also do, honorable members, was to maybe take a quick snapshot of the last 3 months. To say, you know, let's talk about, you know, a situation that is more realistic in terms of where we sit. So if we move into this next slide here, which is slide number 9, is just to try and give a quick indication of the last 3 months in terms of performance, you know, from a network perspective. So if you look at that, you will see, and I think the DG was talking to that to say, you know, although the switching centers would be stable, if you look at July, August, and September, underneath those bars, you can see it's quite a substantial uptime in terms of that. And then if you look at the core links as well, quite a substantial uptime of the networks, you know, the service monitoring, and then, of course, then you've got the access links, which is where we've got these copper issues and so forth. And that is where we begin to see a little bit of a decline there, but still, you know, reasonably above the 95% as well. And then if you go to the right, where we've got the incident categories per month, we just thought let's pull a snapshot so that we can then support what the DG was saying as well about, you know, where are the biggest really challenges. And if you look at that power, if you look at within a month, you know, looking at about 755 incidences, 589, 573 of power, you know, challenges or related challenges. And then, of course, you look into other issues in terms of hardware and so on, you can see then it starts to go down quite substantially. So there are obviously those challenges, obviously with the power being one of the biggest. And of course, we have looked into interventions from UPS, as the DG was saying, to try and make sure that you know, we've got the backup should these things happen. But as you know, also the way these things function is that when you lose the grid power, then you know your UPS will kick in. And then if you then lose that power also, which means after an hour or 2 hours, then the generator now has to kick in. So it goes down to say, now do you have diesel to make sure that the generator runs and all of that. So it just keeps going down into that. And so, of course, if you've got prolonged outages, then it means that then you certainly will then start having major challenges. So just wanted to give that a quick snapshot in terms of that. And I think this slide over here just talks to some of the achievements, and the DG has mentioned some of those. You know, we've spoken about bullet number 3, which looks into the trucks that have finally now been able to implement, and that we continue work on that. If you go to bullet number 2, the DG was talking about the fiber to the banks. As you can see, of the 25 sites, 13 of those have already now been moved into fiber, which is then looking very good. And then we've got 12 that we are now working on, and we've got timelines in making sure that we can achieve those. And I think basically what we're trying to show is that there is indeed, you know, progress that has been made. There's a lot of effort that has been put into making sure that we address the issues. But of course, that does not take away the fact that we have had those challenges as the DG had outlined. And also, it doesn't mean that we will not have challenges moving forward, because networks will always go down. But as we propose now jointly to say, let's have software-defined networks, because we believe this is where the world of IT is going. But also, when you've got software-defined networks, it means that you know, you are able to program easily, you are able to maintain easily, you know, so you are then able to do quite a lot of things, and you're taking the human element out of that space and making sure that the technology begins to manage itself. But what software networks also does is that it then also makes you ready for the cloud services, which is really where all of us are going, to say, let's now use the cloud, because in the cloud, we can then be able to have this infrastructure as a service, which means now you may not necessarily have to have, you know, disparate services or standalone services, you know, which means we can have platforms as a service. We can have software as a service that is now sitting within the cloud. And so it's centralized. It means that you save quite a lot of money and all of that. But of course, all of those require investment. And I think the DG has spoken about the housing of some of the ABs equipment, you know, within the telecom, you know, tier 3 data centers, which was obviously very important to ensure that you've got, you know, dual, you know, power supplies and all of that, really just to make sure that it's uninterruptible. And I think that is what we are driving towards. If we move over, so this really talks to the assessment in terms of what happened. And if members really would allow me, because the slide then tends to be very technical, and so I think we have covered those issues in the most. But essentially what it does is that on top there, as you can see, it begins to show you that, you know, you've got applications, you've got data centers, you've got cybersecurity as a grouping of issues that then needs to be looked at, where both Home Affairs and CETA are looking at that. Then you've got your wide area network, which then CETA drives largely. So you've got CETA, then Home Affairs. And then, of course, you've got the LAN, which is the local area network and facilities. And really just giving more information in terms of where we sit from a diagnosis perspective in each of those. I think, as the DG was saying as well, sometimes you find that there are applications that are down, that then becomes a challenge. If we go to the next slide, sorry, this was just the explanations on those, but I just wanted to move to slide number 13. Then this sort of gives the members a quick picture of these various services that we've got on top in a summary form. If you were to have a quick snapshot of, you know, where does the LAN and desktop sit, you know, where does the WAN sit, and then the hosting functions, the mainframe, and then of course the applications, which will be your basic applications, whether it's you know, Excel spreadsheets and your various and then also it shows you, you know, that the applications obviously is largely DHA driven. You know, the LAN and the desktop, as I said, is DHA driven, and then of course you've got the other functions in between that are largely CETA driven. And then so what is important is that you pull all of this together, and then instead of now converging into a network operating center, you then, because are looking into applications and everything, you then converge into an integrated operating center that will then be able to look into everything that then runs within the pipe. So without getting very technical on that, I think the picture is very clear in terms of what then we mean by trying to converge all of these capabilities and functions. And I think maybe on this slide, which I will not even attempt to get into the details of, but it's just to show that currently this is where we sit. If you look on the left, on top, you've got now your single routers, your single path, and that's where we're saying we want to move from there. An ideal environment we want to be at is at the bottom of the left block at the bottom, which is your dual routers, your dual path. Because once you've got that, then you've got that level of redundancy, and then you've got that level of, and so that is what we are now working towards when we talk about software defined networks and all of that. We're actually moving into that space. But let me not get into the details of that because it tends to be more technical. And then this here then talks to that high availability when. You know, it talks to the modernization roadmap that we then have proposed to say, you know, in year one we can then be able to do this services, in year two we can transition, and in year three we can then be totally transformed into a service. But also we are saying as we transform, you know, it's not a one-off thing that we are now looking at. We are saying, you know, the DG was talking earlier on about, you know, some of the devices, network devices, obviously that still have got some lifespan. So we want to make sure that we accommodate that. So what we are saying is that as we do equipment refresh, we should then make sure that then we move towards a software-defined network-ready equipment, because that's where we are going towards. And I think that's what, with the teams, we are now working towards, to make sure that we do not then go and purchase, you know, old technologies and devices when, you know, the direction that we have carved is very clear to all of us across government. And then, you know, the last issue here was around the procurement. I think also there I just wanted to concur, I think, with the Deputy Minister, you know, with the Minister, with the DG, you know, raising the issue around procurement. And I think the Minister has addressed herself largely to that issue of procurement. I think, honourable members, and we've spoken about this before, we don't want to start sounding like a scratched record, but, you know, in 2017, when a major cleanup happened at CETA, it affected largely the supply chain management, because that's where obviously all the procurement was happening. And as the Minister was saying, you know, this ill of now CETA somehow focusing largely on being a procurement agent more than really leading in the technology and the services that we need to be providing. And so, you know, in total, I think we had about 183 people that had to then, you know, leave the organization within the supply chain management. And when that happened, obviously, it destabilized the actual procurement function of the organization, and that is really what over the time we have all been working towards. making sure that we sort out, because then there's a whole process of supply chain and all of that that we will talk about just now as we talk about the ABIS matter that the DG has put forward. But really, just on that slide, talking about obviously all the challenges related to also including legislative challenges that are there in terms of how you do procurement. So when you now talk for IR and you talk about flexibilities and speed of procurement and all of that, those then need to appeal to us. You know, the DG was talking about our inability to do, you know, very quick, you know, emergency patches. Because, for example, if you look at these links that we were talking about just now, to purchase those, if it becomes, you know, specifically for each and every province, so it's geographically defined and then also project defined. And if you look at the volume of patches that needs to happen, if you have to segment that into the current processes today where you go out on tender and all of that and take 6-7 months on that, you can imagine we will not be able to move on that. And so it becomes important that we can look into what are the, you know, interim alternative measures that we can put in place, you know, if it means engaging with the National Treasury and others. And I think, as the Minister had said, you know, also having put some of these processes like the PMO and all of that to really make sure that we can move with speed in making sure that we can react pretty quickly on the issues that are raised. You know, we're talking about the tracks that eventually happened. I think we're talking about 36 months that it took. But if you look at that whole process, having gone through the process, then having to cancel for the whole year, and then having to restart the process, go through the process again. But also when you look at the nature of procurement, you know, as a service provider, as a potential bidder, when I bid, I will then have a very high level, you know, quotation, you know, based on very high level stuff. I will then put a quotation in, and it's only until I'm awarded that I will then go and do now a proper quotation, because now I must come back to the site and actually do some kind of a POC. And then once I've done that, you'll find that now either the price then goes beyond what the client budgets are and all of that. And that then creates problems where the client also comes and say, but no, we have not budgeted for this kind of amount. I mean, if I look at one of these that we had to turn, that we had to cancel, the gap between the budget and what then came out was quite a huge one. And so I think those processes, really, we need to then be able to say what is then the best way of procuring that we can then look at. So without, again, you know, spending a lot of time on that, you know, we spoke about the challenges with copper and having to move into fiber and the investments, obviously, that are required, which is what that slide then talks to. The next slide also just talks to then how do we then improve the services, especially, you know, your access links. And I think I've already touched on those. And I think that then concludes this part of the presentation on the actual networks. So I think the long and short of it, honourable members, is that I absolutely concur with the presentation by the DG, and of course the inputs that have been made by the ministers. And I think what is important is that we're working on it, we're doing something, and we can see some good traction, as we have seen in the tracks, the speed that we have been able to move, as we have seen with the fiber rollout that we have started driving for the banks' connections. So as we have seen also with a few other, you know, developments around, you know, moving towards, you know, software-defined networks, we have started with that on our side as CETA, because it's important that we do that, you know, that core network and the switching. And as the DG was saying, indeed, it will be unfair to then expect one client to then, you know, have a huge investment in that space. It's important that, of course, as CETA, because we service quite a huge number of clients, that we will then be able to look into the cost from that perspective. So from the networks, I think then that covers that. I think we had prepared a few slides on the ABIS matter, but I'm not sure if maybe we just talk to that or if we want to still go into slides for the ABIS. But basically, it maps out the procurement process that was followed in terms of the ABIS project that the DG was talking to. So
yeah, thank you. Because we gave you a specific time, I would want to allow members to talk to this matter. We'll get back to the other ABIS matter. I see there you say Tumamina, I want to lend a hand. I wonder whether we are really living up to that. But the introduction of the minister about the desirability of CETA itself, I think that is a matter that we really need to talk to Mashuga. Personally, I'm not happy with this presentation. It's too technical. We report to our people and we must tell them why they can't get IDs on time. That's what our people want to know. But if you're going to beam all these trees there, and in the past, because members of parliament were older, they'll be more confused. But I see the majority of the members are younger and they can interact quite clear with these issues. But you agree? So I think I want to give it to you, members. Let's just look into what has been said. Let's deal with what the DM and the minister and other presentation from the DG and from CETA. I want to note hands that you want to. I know Honorable Ross will take 30 minutes because he has been calling. Oh, I want this thing to be discussed. So today CETA is here, Honorable Ross. Honorable Van der Merwe, we'll start from there. You want to start? We'll come. Okay, we'll start with Mr. Ross that way, yeah. Coming this way, in that order. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to be very kind today and just stick to two themes that I've picked up in these presentations. And the one theme was really, you know, looking at the presentation in the beginning and coming up with a solution that we're going to have sort of a three-way tussle to solve the problem. The first thing I thought there is if it seems like Telkom was that the last mile issue was a big issue, and it was brought up even last year in this committee, people discussed that. So my question there was, is Telkom not a part of that three-way discussion? Because to my mind, Telkom has the footprint out there in the space, and it seems like a lot of the feedback, even from last year and in the media, was that sometimes a router might be off and then there's nobody to switch it on. Or is the power off? How do you verify that? And so certainly, you know, it seems like 99.72% uptime from CETA's side, and then it drops down on the other side due to issues of electricity, routers, etc. It goes down to 96% or whatever, which in real terms, it's about 3 or 4 days for every single, 3 or 4 days of downtime for every single office, which you can add it all up. It's about 1,200 days. So it's quite significant. My other question in that regard then, and again, I've asked it before, but I'm asking it again for the context of this discussion, is that when these services are down, then you lose as the department because you can't issue. The public loses because they've come there, now they have to go home. What penalties are there for the service providers for downtime? Then just from a, you know, I'm glad the Minister of Communications is here, and I was interested to hear the discussion about CETA becoming more like an IT company. My understanding of CETA's initial purpose was that it would be a transversal, it would seek transversal contracts to make it easier for government departments, that you can benefit from economies of scale, get cheaper services, have the experts there. You know, we have experts. You can't expect Home Affairs to have expert IT personnel. It's very difficult. So a number of years ago, there was talk in CETA of a cradle-to-grave project. And to my mind, with the fourth industrial revolution, where you look at sort of data centers and great connectivity, there's also a general feeling that it doesn't make sense that you have, home affairs might have this problem, and then you have education might have that problem, and health has that problem. Are they all separately procuring connectivity? Or is there any move to say, let's have a massive government data center where we secure our data properly, where the different government departments have access to a single source of truth, where the whole POPIA, protection of personal information, is rigorously enforced with the right agents there. Because now it seems like we're going to go down to the next few years, down a road of sort of client-server, and we're going to try and fix it and try and fix the old way of doing things. Is there that vision in place of having this big data center servicing government departments, big connectivity projects to connect hubs? Because let's say you have Nelspruit and there's a number of government departments. Why should they each have their separate one? So I'd just like to understand the vision in that regard from communications point of view. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'll take Honorable Ross' time today. Chairperson, for starters, and I want to fully support you on the technicality of this report. And when one is confronted with a report of this nature, I think for future purposes, it is important for CETA to have a list of abbreviations and acronyms for us to understand. I think that is important. I even want to go further. If you look at the content of this report, it should also have had a glossary of important terms. We talk about devices here. And to a greater extent, sometimes we have a small device as your thumb at the price of 100,000 rand. Where I come from, in some systems, they're selling it for 1 million rand. So I think that is important because all of us are not technically declined. I am a little bit confused, perturbed on the nature of this presentation. And as you are aware, Chair, that members of this committee, they read, they listen. And a very important factor is that my take on today's meeting was that CETA would have come here and discussed with us the downtime, the problems that we have. And if CETA was a fly on the wall since May, even the minister have said, I want to get rid of CETA for the useless service rendered to this department. I think the very first three speakers, almost their very first sentence, there was the word used, downtime. The DGs speak about downtime, longer period. And surprisingly so, that I don't know why CETA has been scared. I haven't even heard nothing about the fourth industrial revolution. But in terms of service, I want to categorically state it, that as far as services is concerned, dollar law. I wrote a question to the minister on the department's website, the downtime, and also the dysfunctional, what measures have been made, and we have and received very polite answers. Some of the answers are, there's no such thing, there was an outage on the internet links to CETA on 11 August and it was restored the following day. The outage affected all government departments connecting to CETA. We're hearing contrary stuff here today. And we must also perhaps take this house a little bit back on who am I online, where there is an agreement with CETA and this department, and maybe check. We must also flag this one to go out and to have a look on where these representatives or workers is actually busy out there in the field as far as that
agreement is concerned. You have made it very clear, I think the DG, very clear, and requested CETA to respond on the AG report, on the irregular contract. I'm not sure, but if my memory serves me right, it was 200 million, if I'm right, that was reported. I'm not sure about the amount. And I'm not sure whether money has been paid out. And if money has been paid out, we as a portfolio committee, in terms of our oversight, must also go out and to see whether Home Affairs did receive that service. And it's actually an indictment for this committee to find itself in a situation whereby master files just get flushed. If you talk about CETA, you talk about IT, and most of these things, and the passion that this committee and the minister and the deputy minister has is port of entries and all of that, and service delivery are being affected in a number of places in our rural areas, because rightfully so, we rely on network availability. Do we have network? No. We don't have network. And I agree with Minister Stella in saying that we have to remodel CETA. I actually want to say CETA must remodel themselves. They must remodel themselves when it comes to the whole structure of them. I want to go to a few things. There are words being used, most devices are obsolete. Now, they are no longer in use, they can't be used, it must be replaced, they are obsolete. Now, I cannot understand, if you read through all of these documents, if there was a contract, and to a greater extent said that Home Affairs themselves should have serviced that contract, what has been done as far as services of a contract is concerned, and to prevent all of these? For me, I feel it's like a courtyard. We are sitting here and dating one another to have some nice contracts. This is how I see this document. While we as a committee has made it very clear there must be engagement with the minister so that we can revisit the act in terms of have this kind of marriage with CETA. So CETA is not explaining to us the real province, the real problems that we have. The DG has explained to us the local area network. If one is down, the whole local area of network is down, LAN. What about the wide area networks? That is the problems that we are facing, and we don't have a satisfaction on all of these. When you go to some of these Home Affairs offices, if one is off, the whole LAN is off. So I'm not interested in new devices, what we have to do. If you look at the financial implications, it's a lot of money. I want to read something to us, Chair. That although many of the devices are obsolete and aging from a life cycle perspective, this was not seen as a contributing factor to the outages. Now, what was then seen as a factor to the outage if some of these devices are not? And how many and what kind of devices are we talking here? Review replacement of devices that have reached obsolete status in line with our architecture strategy. Which devices are this? And in some extent they're saying ensure failure coverages of devices through a maintenance contract. Do we have a maintenance contract? Or don't we have a maintenance contract? Now, it also invite us to migrate from bronze to bronze plus. If you read one of the other reports, I think of Home Affairs, it says to us that there's a suggestion by CETA asking us to go from bronze to gold, jump 1, 2, 3. From bronze to gold. I see this effort of what is presented to us as another
money making scheme. If you look from bronze to bronze plus, yeah, there are 5 or 10 days differences when it comes to services. On one issue, it says the assessment which provides, I need some clarity on this, 34 areas of improvement, which 32 were the responsibility of DHA to address and 2 were the responsibility of CETA. So, and it also said C attached. I couldn't find the attached slides containing the assessment details. So I think we are in real danger, and once we are going out here as a collective to really address the problems that we have within home affairs. Because my problem, Chairperson, since May, when we had discussions, and everyone was in agreement that the dinosaurs in the room is CETA. Every time when we discuss the issues of CETA, there were no indication from the department that there was engagements with CETA on some of these issues. So I think CETA is something to explain as far as that contract and the misplacing of very important documents is concerned. And CETA really have to speak to the controversial issues as far as downtime is concerned. That is the bottom line of our problem, because we are reliant on network and nothing else. Network and network and nothing else. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Kanyile.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've been partially covered by my colleagues, and we welcome the presentations that have been presented before us. One of the presenters indicated that they have about 100 trucks that are going to be connected before the end of the current financial year. And I remember we had a number of provincial reports where the provincial managers indicated that they have refurbished the trucks, but that the trucks are without connectivity. In September, I was in Gwamgwamhlabuyalingana. The presenter made an example about Gwamgwamhlabuyalingana as well. When we got there, one of the issues that were raised by the people of Gwamgwamhlabuyalingana in Gomkhanyakude was the fact that when they visit the home affairs offices, most times they find that their offices are offline. And their offices are 200 kilometers away from where they reside. They must travel 200 kilometers and they pay 200 rands for transport. And you must remember that most of these people, they are unemployed. And if they get there and wait on the queue the whole day without assistance, what they normally do, they will have to get accommodation from the neighbors and pay about 70 rands to sleep over, so that they can be able to attend to the office tomorrow and come back with the same transport, because if they have to go there twice, they'll have to pay 400 rand. My question to the department is that can they tell us why did they close the offices in Umkhanyakude? Because at the moment, the only offices that are servicing people of Umkhanyakude are the one in Mbazwane. And what are the chances of the department opening the offices of Umkhanyakude while they are still busy trying to fix the issue of the mobile unit? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, the Minister elaborated on the issues of corruption when she started this presentation. I just want to ask, on the people that were suspended and the ones that were taken out, the CEO spoke about 138 people. Were there any criminal charges laid against those people, and did we maybe get some of the money back which those people took away from the CETA? And also on the documents issues, CETA is coming here and is telling us that there are some of the documents that are missing in the files. How come whenever there is something, because of whenever you are procuring something from someone, there must be proper documents in each and every file. So they must also explain on that one and also on the ABUS. Because of here, on the last presentation of the AG, the AG told us that there is an irregular expenditure of 376 million, which was an irregular expenditure which was occurred from the ABUS side. So they must just also elaborate on that one, and the other questions, they will come. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very, very much, Chairperson. I would like to start off by reading just a quick sentence from minutes of a meeting held by this portfolio committee last year. It's a year ago. And it says, members expressed serious concern and frustration because CETA had appeared several times before the committee for similar incidents, and that was off time or downtime, and each time made promises and assured the committee that it found solutions, yet the problem persisted. Some members proposed that DHA divorces from CETA. And so, Chairperson, I would like to say that not only was this presentation very technical today, and I don't think it was very helpful for any of us, but what I would have wanted to hear was the minister recently said in the last couple of weeks 412 offices were offline for 2 days. And I would have wanted CETA to come and tell us, with regard to those 412 offices that were offline, what were the problems, what were the challenges, and what urgent interventions would be put in place. But what is really lacking for me from this presentation, and I'm not really going to be asking questions, but I'm actually quite, you know, I'm flabbergasted, because we talk about the fact that downtime offices, there's no sense of urgency or concern that in fact it is SASSA pensioners or people who travel, like Honourable Kanyile said, people who travel very far with their SASSA grants to go and apply for documents over and over and over again. They don't have the means to do so. So when we do talk about downtime, we should really, there's no sense of urgency to address it. It seems like, you know, you talk about we've been made a request for connectivity for mobile units in 2016. And then the last slide says, it took over 36 months to get a service provider. In what world can it take 36 months to get a service provider? And I actually feel really sorry for the Department of Home Affairs, because we put a lot of pressure on you. Every time you come here, we're asking you about the mobile units, because we want the mobile units to be operational in rural areas. And we ask you about the issues of ports of entry. But you are not being helped by CETA. And I don't understand, why are we still entertaining, because now, Minister, I hear you, you are saying we should reform or revamp CETA. But if you take 36 months to get a service provider for mobile units, how long is it going to take to revamp you? 5 years, 6 years, 7 years? And meanwhile, the last week, for example, Pinetown offices were offline, Umgeni offices were offline. So we didn't need this very technical presentation here today about landline and, you know, and also the issue, if we know copper is being stolen, then surely we should start to focus to say, can CETA get us to a point where we've got wireless services or not? And if you're not able to do the job, then so we'll have to look at policy changes that will enable the Department of Home Affairs to be assisted otherwise. Because otherwise, I fear I'm gonna end this term in Parliament, and I'm going to come back and we'll still be talking about offices that are offline. And please, it is not just offices that are offline, we're talking about people's lives. It's a go-go who has to sit in a queue and has to spend 30 rand because she cannot collect her ID today. And then she cannot collect a grant. Or she has to go back and now she spent all her SASSA grant money because she had to go up and down to come to Home Affairs offices that are offline. So unfortunately, I don't think we've received, you know, Chairperson, we cannot leave this room today and actually think that there's been any intervention here. There's a lack of urgency. There's a lack of seriousness. And the thing is, we can ask, you know, really, we can ask technical questions about why are you still using, you know, obsolete units, but it's not going to help us. What is the plan of action to get offices that are perpetually offline, online, keep them online, and do we have a plan of action that will actually help us in the next 12 months or not? And I think that is all I want to say for now, Chairperson.
Not only good.
The first point perhaps I would like to make is that it's important for anybody and everybody to understand that when we are in this committee, we are elected representatives of the people of South Africa. It does not matter what political party we are in. We carry the responsibility of budgeting public funds, sending public funds out, so that those who are in the executive are able to use those resources to improve the life conditions of our people. We don't have 3 years to sit looking how to correct a mistake that we have noticed 4 or 5 years ago. We don't have that time. Because people will be taking their decisions whether we are with or while, and their lives are moving on and they are passing away, they are dying. Their children are losing their lives and so on. So we can't be so laxed as we are here. We cannot think that we have plenty time to toy with what we need to do to change this individual and put that one there, and maybe we can get somebody to do that. We must be very exact about the things. My neighbor here, Comrade Chairperson, likes to tease me about old age and so on. But one thing that many people do not realize is that all the complex things that we are talking or dealing with today, they started as a very simple instrument, like a camera. You know, with a camera, you just had to get something that you could put a lens, there's the individual, and you can take the picture and record it on this thing and do that. So those cameras of old, they were very small, much smaller than that thing. Very much smaller. But you could take a picture with it, at least black and white. And then somebody added a little bit of something, and another one added a little bit of something. And then it becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. But even as that process is happening, we have to look, and people keep thinking, how can we still let it do that with all these functions, but smaller? Now, why did we set up a CETA? Because at some point, doing everything in one department, everything there, became too big. So you take this function and you put it away, and you take it and you put it away, and so on. Now we are in a position in which we can, all of these functions that are different, that CETA is supposed to be doing, they don't need to sit there alone. We can get one individual who can work in the department, who can do quite a number of things and so on, without having a separate organization, which takes huge amounts of money. And that's why the government today say, there is no money. Why Minister of Finance said, there's no money, we must save money so that we can do more things for the people, instead of having a huge government with thousands of people, many of whom are doing nothing. We must change this thing. I say to you, we are all of us are responsible and accountable if government is not doing well. We must answer to that. We meet our people on the street. They don't care what party you are in. So what are you guys doing? What are you doing with our money? Why are you not doing this for us and so on? So we must really take a decision whether we need, as the DG was saying, whether we need to have Home Affairs without the function. Home Affairs now takes its budget and pays a group of men and women to go and do what? Find how to get rid of copper out of some wire and so on. Why do we need Home Affairs to take millions of rands to go and pay a group of people to go and look for that thing and so on? We now know where the copper is, because all the all the pipes with copper in them and so on are registered. And so we know where they are. We get this is done. So we don't need this whole big group of people go and look for that thing and so on. And Chairperson, this committee must take a decision. My inclination is that we ought to say to Home Affairs, please don't go on debating with some of your colleagues, all of you in ties, debating how to get rid of the copper and all of that. You guys sort out your problem here in Home Affairs. And if education has got a similar problem, they must do that same thing and so on. And then you don't have a huge, big organization that's got to go and do one thing, take copper out for education, for Home Affairs, for the hospitals, and all of that. It's a waste of our time. And so all these technical things are good because they now tell us where we need to remove this copper. So now that we know that information, it's just all of us, all the departments must know that. We've got to say now, can a department get somebody? Where is pipes at that? Get rid of that individual and do this and so on. And then get most of the money going to the people. When this comrade was asking why the people are going to Mkanyagudi and why the people are going to... Because there was, word was, look, we will make you those clouds which were here. We will make those clouds and we will send electricity all over and everything will be done and so on. But what then what happens is there's no electricity. So now these old people must go to Mkanyagudi because electricity is not going there. You see, this is the kind of thing that's happening to us, sir. See, the relationship, the structure that we set up, at some point we believed it was going to serve us. I was part of government when that was that. I'm getting older and older. This year, I finished another year. Next year, I'll finish another year. It can't go on like that, Chen said. We must act, and we must act with urgency. Thank you.
No, thanks, Chair. I'm covered with some of the issues which are raised by our colleagues. Only two issues, Chair, which I wanted to raise with the department. I think, Chair, on the Auditor General, there's an issue on the EOH, and I think we must task both CETA and the department to come with a detailed report on the matter, because it appears, I think if you go down, there's a narrative that suggests that there's a possible collision on the issues of this contract, and which is expressed by the Auditor General. And I would suggest, Chair, that we may need to press hard for, so that we're able to process a decision on how we must move forward on this area. The second issue, Chair, if you look on the previous report, I think CETA has been having challenges on this downtown corrupt activities that have been outlined. We may need to be taken into space in terms of progress since the last fifth parliament, in terms of the issues that we identify on CETA problems, the issues that they must work on if they've initially worked on, and what are the implications that they have with Home Affairs in terms of this the downtown line. The minister, there's an area I think which we're not exposing. I think we, both the DM and the minister and the DG and CETA may need to expose it to us. There's a narrative that suggests that CETA is a corrupt entity across the board. All departments are crying about it. We hear you suspending people and so forth and so on. But as a veteran, when the ages are also accumulating, for how long are going to reside with the sitter that is highly corrupt? And you, at the level of executive, you are presiding over this institution. So we need to be exposed to that chair so that processing the portfolio committee decision, we may have to be empowered on what are the areas we must venture in with this institution. I agree absolutely, a veteran, that Honorable Gota, there must be a time of evaluation whether this CETA is still relevant to be used by departments. We may need to arrive at that space, whether there are certain services that they can reside within the department, certain services that can reside within CETA. I think those are the areas that I think we must be able to arrive at as a portfolio committee, so they're able to move forward. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's very depressing to hear the comments of members, Honorable Deputy Minister and Honorable Minister. But it is clear that we can't just leave the house and as if everything is normal. Like now, what is in the report is that people have been suspended. Where are these people? They're suspended, and where? What is the? Because Parliament cannot just get a report that people are suspended, then that's it. Where is the process? The criminal cases open? How far are those cases? Because it's clearing now that there's a lot of money lost through the CETA. But I like your attitude, Honorable Minister, that I think something must be done. I think a debate must ensue now whether we need these sitters. And if we do, we need them in this current form. Because if what you say is indeed correct, that the department requests sitter for a service, sitter is still going to request somebody for a service, then that is not in the interest of our people. And from what sitter is saying, even the report, I agree with Honorable van der Merwe that it's not only technical, but it can't help. We're not in a space where we're being assisted or we feel being helped by the sitter. So because you two, I see you are still younger, maybe you convince the executive to take decisions. I think the discussion whether we need sitters, but certainly at Home Affairs, I agree with the minister, we don't need for the service that we do, because we blame every day the department comes here, it looks like the department is not doing its work properly. Even myself, I'm inundated with a lot of complaints, like I'm in the executive, from the communities about the work of the Home Affairs. But it is clear that Home Affairs has its own portion, but the larger portion is because of CETA. But the levels of corruption that are also displayed here are also something else. I'm sure Patoi has a lot of work. Maybe in the next meeting we must also call the NPA so that they sit here and look into this report and see what else can they do in the interest of our people. Because we can't just keep quiet. If we keep quiet as the legislature, then who else is going to be speaking for our people? I think we're not going to, but I'm very happy that the minister is here, responsible for the CETA. Deputy Minister is here, responsible for Home Affairs, but we need decisions. We're going to take that other presentation now. I think you'll get to see clearer now how people are laxed. The laser's fair in terms of people doing their work. Money spent in millions. There's no work done because maybe it involves IT. People say, we don't understand IT, but we are now quite educated about these IT issues. We know these things and we want answers. I think let's take this quick discussion, but I just want the minister, as he'll be closing and later on the matters, to give us a roadmap and a clearer roadmap on what we must do, what we must commit, because we're a committee of parliament. These issues that we're discussing here, we'll have to take them to the House. That this is what is happening, and we can't fold our arms. We need to do something, both as parliament and as executive, in terms of ensuring that we assist the ministers to do their work in a manner that will take this country forward. I don't know who's presenting on the next report. Still sitting.
Chair, we have prepared our own report in relation to this matter, but also CITA has prepared their own reports. So I'm not sure whether you'd want to take both presentations or what CITA, the procurement bag, can talk to what the process was.
Members?
Chair, with your permission, I was going to say that we could hear whatever the committee, I mean the departments may want to say. We do need to sit as our committee, as a committee, portfolio committee, to then decide how we're going to deal with this matter. First of all, because I don't think we can ask the minister and deputy minister to tell us what they think about it. They'll talk about that when they get to cabinet. We're going to report to parliament. We must take a decision, and we need to get this question raised also in the other departments. To say that, you know, all of us have got this problem, and many of us serve in more than one committee, and we know that the mood also in those departments, there is a mood that says no. There's a huge amount. You see this double tendering system, among other things, is just where a lot of public funds are flowing out of government and getting lost. So if we can hear whatever the committee needs to say to us, and then when they are not there, we must meet by ourselves and we must say, as a committee, this is what we want to recommend to parliament and in the other committees as well, so that quick enough, some decision can be taken. We are still going to meet the CITA again in the Department of Education, in the Department of electricity and all of those kind of things is going to be there. But we must make a decision indicating also, because we have to respond also to the Minister of Finance's proposals, who's concerned about the fact that there's a lot of money that is lost in the government, and we are not acting on it. Thank you, sir.
Okay, I agree with you. But let's take Honourable Van der Merwe wanted to say something.
I was proposing that maybe we just take CITA chairperson, because Home Affairs, we've read through the document. But Home Affairs also giving us a problem statement, but we're looking towards CITA to give us the answer to the problems. So rather not just restate the problems, because we know what they are. So maybe we should ask CITA to speak to the issues. That's my proposal.
Okay. Yeah, that proposal is properly seconded. CITA, can you do that? And to please give details. If you say people are involved, documents are lost, what happens when the document is lost? We just say, we clap hands that the documents are lost, we reconstruct them, and then business as usual. Over to you.
Thanks, Chair, honorable members. So we have prepared a presentation here, Chair, that talks to the process, because we wanted to then respond to the question of what exactly has been the process in this particular deal. So the DG has touched on that in his opening. I think that's what Honourable Member refers to as the problem statement. So I want to then be able to, the presentation then talks from there, if the House can allow. All right. Thank you very much, Chair. So as I've said, Chair, the purpose of the presentation right now is then to be able to take us through the process that was followed in the appointment of the service provider for the ABIS program for the Department of Home Affairs. The DG has indicated that this was a two-phased initiative or bidding process. The first phase was what we call an RFA, which is the request for accreditation. So what you would then do in this process is that you would want to then call on a number of service providers and then be able to go through a rigorous system or process of making sure that you can then appoint them on the panel so that you can then later move into a closed request for proposal process. So phase one then was the RFA, and then phase two was the RFP, which would then help us in selecting and appointing the actual service provider.
I thought that what we are saying is that we want to move towards a process of what we want to recommend. What I'm hearing from the gentleman is that he's telling us what they did, and they had this and that and the other. I think the chairperson asked the question rather very pointedly.
Yes.
When you discovered that the documents were missing, when you found that there were people that had done something wrong and something and so on, what has been action taken to correct these things? Because we want to make recommendations when you go back to the house.
Yes.
So we need to get information that will enable us to enhance, to strengthen the arm of government in terms of acting against all these excesses that are happening.
Honourable Minister.
Thank you, Chair. With your permission, I would request clarity. Are we continuing with the presentation, or we must just respond to the matters that the honourable members have raised? Because if we're just responding to the questions and the concerns by the honourable members, it means we're putting the presentation aside. If we're providing clarity on the delays in procurement, we have to take the members through the step, the process that was followed to say, we started this process on this date, and this is what led to the delay. But I just want clarity. Do we go ahead with the presentation, or we respond to the concerns that have been raised?
Yeah, thanks. I think what has happened is we've requested a presentation, but I see, like I said earlier, the presentations are intertwined. When you speak to that of Home Affairs, they refer to the issue of ABs, they refer to the other things. So what we needed to patch on now was that we get a response by CETA on this specific contract, ABs. Actually, it must not be, I agree with the Honourable Likud, it must not be about, it is common cause that you would advertise. We're at a point where documents are lost of the same thing. So to start afresh, from where you started, when we're at the point where documents were lost and so on, we want to know the portion which documents were lost, certain amounts were paid for not work done, what is happening, where are we in terms of that process, so that our recommendation to Parliament must be clear, so that if the committee meets and recommend to call Patoi in the meeting, we're quite clear in terms of that. But to start afresh, as if we don't have the information that is in the document, it may be not only wasting time, but it may be taking us back in terms of, if we can concentrate ABIS, EHO, what has happened, the monies were not paid, who is responsible, and then so that we can then allow you to respond. In your response, then at the end of the day, then we would, as a committee, look into this matter and have an impression as requested.
Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I think yes. Let me respond to the issues, and maybe just a little bit in 1 minute, Chair, because then to respond to the issue, I just want to be able to give you just a little bit of a context. So where we are on this ABIS matter, Chair, is that the Auditor General had raised the issue as a finding that we will then have a limitation of scope because not sufficient information has been found. Now, which then goes to the master file that we are addressing ourselves to. So first of all, there's two issues that we wanted to address. Obviously, is the issue around the documentation in terms of the master file, but there was also another finding in terms of the Ernst & Young matter that I think the DG raised eloquently earlier on. So what has happened here in terms of the master file, so that I address myself specifically to the master file, Chair. In 2016, and that is that context. So in 2016, we, of course, when you do this tender process, you will always have the internal audit involved at every step of the way, whether it's around the specification development. You will then have to make sure that the internal audit is involved. So at that level, internal audit has been involved in the process. They've looked at that. And in that report of the internal audit, I'm just trying to track the master file so that we come to a point where, you know, we talk about where the master file then started getting lost. So in that internal audit, the reference point was the master file. So that is very clearly documented in the internal audit, because we went to track, also as new people at CETA ourselves, you know, to try and understand what was the process. And so we looked into that, and then we could see that yes, the reference to the master file, so it is still in place. And the Department of Home Affairs also had their own internal audit, which then in 2017.
Yeah. That's right.
I think we must help also the members, the administration. First of all, Comrade Chairperson, let us just mention to everybody, we are members of Parliament. The Constitution says that the Parliament must hold the executive to account. Parliament has that responsibility. Now, there is no secret that can be kept from us. And when you come here as staff, you come with the minister, deputy minister. Actually, strictly speaking, you shouldn't be saying anything. The minister should have gotten all the information accurately, and the minister can say, we found this, and this is who we found. We suspended so-and-so, and this is the reason. That's where the process is. The deputy minister, if the minister is not here, should do the similar thing. Because we, members of the committee, we are only representing that majority of the 400 members sitting in the National Assembly. No one must come to a meeting of the portfolio committee sent by the speaker or the councilor, chairperson of the Council of Province, and feel that there are certain secrets I must keep, you know, maybe I cannot say this and so on. Because the minister will have told you, you go and say this to that committee. You go and say that to the National Assembly. Or you can come with me, you'll remind me about some of the things I'm going to tell. This is what I'm going to tell Parliament. I'm saying that, comrade, because when we ask you, what happened to the people you found and suspended? Why did you suspend them?
You must have found that they've done something wrong. What is it that they've done wrong? How much money did they steal? Who did they bribe? You must tell us. This is the sitting of the House. And we are bound to take that information and go write our report and give it to the National Assembly. For the National Assembly to take action, to make law. If there's law that is wrong, correct the law that's wrong, amend it, and then do that. I'm saying this, committee chairperson, because many people think that the portfolio committee is just where you go and maybe chat and make some jokes and something like that. It's not like that. It is not like that. It is as I'm telling you now. We have taken an oath of office, comrades, that we will do this, and that you must read the Constitution. You'll see what we say in the oath of office that we take. So we are here serious on duty. I'm making that point because I wanted to make sure, Chairperson, that members coming from the department and so on, when they talk to us here, they must understand they are talking to Parliament. And you yourself are bound to tell Parliament the truth, nothing but the truth. Because we are going to quote you and in the House, and if you are lying, you can be arrested and you can be sentenced to prison. We ourselves, if we lie here, we can find ourselves in serious difficulties, including imprisonment. So that is what this whole thing is about here. Chairperson, I just wanted to make that interview.
Yeah, thank you.
We really want to know what is happening in the department.
Actually, what I wanted to propose to members was that because we have the report before us, and as requested that we will meet after this thing as members to process this particular issue. And I don't think the sitter is assisting us. Continuing to present, it will take our time to reflect. Actually, I want to stop that presentation from then, allow the politicians to respond. Other issues are in the document. We will discuss as members when presentations are done. Can I allow the Deputy Minister and the Minister to respond so to go forward?
No, thank you, Chair, for the correct sequence of events so that we are all on the same page on this matter, first and foremost, is that there was a contract that Home Affairs wanted to migrate from Harness to APIS. And the procurement process was carried on by SITA to save his Home Affairs. And then when AG came, he raised the issue of just about 200 million. As potential irregular expenditure. The reason for that was because they felt that there was something wrong with the manner in which the contract was awarded. They then raised issues with Home Affairs and said that the first issue is around the incomplete documentation, which means the limitation of scope in a technical term. We then had the responsibility to reconstruct the file and say from Home Affairs, these are the records we have, so that we can also assist SITA to say here are all the records. The process was done and the file was reconstructed and given to the Auditor General. The Auditor General, on engagement with Home Affairs, then said, we accept the file you've given us, and then we agreed that this will be flagged as irregular expenditure pending an investigation, which means that subsequent to the finding, there must now be an investigation to look into the documents and verify everything, and then Auditor General will then issue the final finding on this matter. And that is where we are in terms of now doing that particular investigation. And we know that SITA has been doing work also on their side around this issue, which is where the arrests will have been affected from now on. What we can do now is that as Home Affairs, in terms of operational now, what does this mean operationally for us? How do we move forward? And I would request that the committee gives us time to go and look at what does this mean for us and how we are going to continue. Because at the end of the day, we have a project at our hands, and that project must be seen to completion and then put the facts on the table. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Just to add to what the DM has said, firstly, let me take responsibility and apologize to the honorable members for the presentation that was too technical. We'll make sure that next time it's easier, because it's not the last time we are appearing here, as we're going to continue working together. So we'll make sure that it's simplified, or at least get parliamentary researchers and content people to simplify it according to the language that is used in the committee, so that they can work together with us. And of course, honorable members, it has been of concern, as I said earlier, which is why we took a decision that it's important that we intervene urgently by making sure that we establish the PMO that must look into these areas that are specific that the DM is talking to. But the work has to be done. It doesn't mean that now, because we're going to be reconsidering the CETA, if it must still be there or not, there's work right now that needs to be done. And therefore, we are going to set up a committee that must look into that, the PMO, as I said earlier. And in relation to the matters that the DM also made mention of, the IRS, it's just that now the CEO is busy going all over the shops in terms of telling us where are the people. But we had received reports and we reported to Parliament. It's just that now I don't have those nitty-gritties to say where are they specifically right now. But the minute we got the investigation and then the reports, we said let people be arrested and let an action plan be taken in terms of recouping monies when necessary. Hence I said the state law enforcement agencies were the ones that were driving the work. But now I don't have the latest in terms of where, how far are they. But I commit to the committee to make sure that by the end of this week we would have sought all that information so that we can share, just to make sure that as honourable members are doing their work, at least they are informed as to the processes that we have undertaken as the portfolio committee. But of course, honourable members, as I mentioned earlier, that the challenges that we face arise from the past, which is why now you hear yourself saying probably let's reconsider even the decision that we took to establish a CETA that is the CETA that is, as the honourable Royce that side correctly put it, that initially CETA was just there for as a transversal company, which is something again that's going to continue because we've got to leverage on the numbers that we have. But now all we are emphasizing in this, as part of repurposing CETA, is to say it can't just be a reseller. As much as we have to leverage on what is there, but CETA has to be that IT company that drives the innovation and be able, as departments require services, application development and other services, that the CETA is the one that must be looking into that. The president announced on the reconfiguration of the state, which is another process that we have to align with. Because once the president then says, these are the entities that come together, this is whatever that we do away with, and then we're able to say specifically, as we are working towards this process in this department, therefore CETA, as I said earlier on, in terms of them dropping certain services and focusing on other areas, that's the only time we'll be able to come back and do that, because we have to wait for all those processes that are prescribed that we must follow. And in relation to CETA and the issue of data centers, as CETA has already made sure that they get a government cloud whereby they want to put all the information in it. Of course, there are issues around security that we had the security cluster departments engaging on in terms of the location of the cloud, which is under Microsoft, Huawei, and Kijima. So those matters are being addressed to say, how do we, because we need not physically go and have the data centers if we have the cloud, but how do we make sure that the cloud that is there is responsive and is able to carry out the services that needs to be carried out. The networks, colleagues, are there, but the challenge is these power outages, Honorable Maglowa. When I responded to your question based on the advice that I got from CETA, as you were saying, there seemed to be contradiction in the provision of the information that's being put here. Indeed, as I said, at times it is the network that is down. At times it's the power outage that affects everyone. And CETA connects through the points of presence that are based at Centurion, as the DG was making reference to. And then therefore are
affects all the other entities, which is something now they said they are working on to say how do they address that, including making sure that if there's a power outage, let there be a generator that kicks up so that the services are not affected. That's why when we talk about the work that we do, we also say there's a need to ensure that there's a reliable electricity. Because if reliable electricity is not provided, then it hammers on the work that we're doing, and then we always experience these challenges. The last one, okay, DM, I think you forgot to respond on the Mkanyakote issue. The last one on the corrupt sitter, we're not going to lie, Comrade. Corruption is there. That is why we've arrested people. And as I'm saying, corruption is there. Unfortunately, the investigation indicates that corruption comes from the client and the sitter that procures. So it's a two-way process that we are faced with. But unfortunately, when the law enforcement agencies have not concretized, we're not able to jump to certain things. We've got to await all those. But indeed, as I said, from 2017, this is what we've been talking about, which is why we're considering certain options, therefore, to remodel and see what is it that will work and try to minimize and eliminate the levels of corruption. But it is there that we can't shy away from, Honorable Court. It's the reality that we're faced with, which is why we said if we are appointing new boards, we've got to take into consideration the level of state culture, the level of corruption and all that. How do we then make sure that we complement the work that is there so that they can be able to be responsive to the needs of the day-to-day activities by the department? On the issue of the clear roadmap, Chairperson, clear roadmap of on the way forward, how do we plan? We must present that. You said we must do that. I spoke of the establishment of the project management office. I then said I request that we don't put time frame until we have met because it affects certain departments, not only just us. So I said we request that we be given time at least 7 days so that when we concretize, we know that it's an actionable plan and practical instead of us just time sucking. And we do commit that indeed we'll do our best in ensuring that the matters are not affecting the service delivery that's supposed to be enjoyed by our people. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. I'll just deal with the issue of Umhlabuyalingana. Umhlabuyalingana is in Mkhanyakude district. What we have in Umhlabuyalingana, because I must indicate that we've been there twice already in the past 4 months. What we observed is that we do have an office, but the office is not a modern office, which means it does not issue smart card IDs. And as such, that is why people of Mkhanyakude now have to travel to Mbazwana. It's still within the district of Mkhanyakude. They have to travel to Mbazwana to get services for them to have the smart card ID. The permanent solution there was that there is a place that we had been given by Department of Public Works right next to the police station in Umhlabuyalingana. I've went and seen that particular place myself. There were issues raised by the local tribal authority, which felt that probably that office is a bit on the side, and they would rather like give us land in town so that we can be able to build an office. But unfortunately, Home Affairs, as you will all know, cannot buy offices. That is done for us by Public Works. That is what is happening. So that is where the delay is now. And as such, we are now in discussion with Public Works whether we should continue with that office, but they have allocated that particular space for us. Now, the issue is that to solve this rural location, the plan was that these trucks, that's where they then become critical. And part of the reason why we went with those trucks to Mkhanyakude, to Umhlabuyalingana, was to test the solution that we finally got from CETA. And that solution, we can guarantee it works. We were in a vicinity of about just above 500 people, and we were able to service about 178 people that came through the trucks. They never at any point disconnected, which means they work, and that has been piloted. The issue now is that we must then put it the same solution to the other trucks and thereafter be able to attend to rural communities using these trucks whilst we resolve our infrastructure problems with the Department of Public Works. So that is the problem we are facing and that is the solution we are bringing and that we are implementing. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. We are going to go to the last two presentations so that we can have a space for members to reflect on the other matter later. And Minister, you can be indulged if you can sit because you want to sit, but issues that relate to your department are exhausted for now. And thank you much for coming, for respecting a committee of parliament by coming yourself. We don't take that very light. You are being available to attend to issues of to committees of parliament. If you sit, maybe on your own, you can proceed with the last two presentations quickly so that you can have time. Honorable Rose? I take it, Honorable Rose, some of your questions are relating to what we must discuss afterwards, like what happened to the penalty. The penalties and so on, those are the issues that we must still visit. I feel that, like we need to, as a committee, get closer to these CETA-related issues. So we need to zoom quite closer. To have them answered now, it will be just in window dressing. So I think let's get closer to the issues as the committee. Then we'll then take a decision whether we'll need them here to answer specific issues or what do we do going forward. But now I want us to have ample time for us to discuss those issues, if you agree.
Yeah, just the issue of why Telkom was not involved, since as they, it's such an important part at the end. It's important that we get that input, so we understand why are they not involved in the discussion about providing the service. That's the only really critical question.
Okay. Honorable Minister, who's answering this one?
Yes, thank you very much, Chair. Yes, we do work very closely with Telkom. They are a service provider, obviously. So they actually do those linkages to the Department of Home Affairs offices that we spoke about. In terms of maintenance, so maintenance is then provided from there. The DHA obviously takes responsibility for the maintenance at the DHA offices directly. But so yes, we do work with Telkom. We do work with other service providers as well, including your Liquid Telecoms, your Vodacoms, your MTNs, as telcos as well. So we do work with all of them through various contracts.
No, let's not add to this question because this is, Honorable Ross can see now, it's part of a discussion that we must take forward. It's fine. Let's take other presentation. We'll have a chance to discuss later on.
Yes, Honorable Member, yes, we do have a contract with Telco. Yes, that's CETA. Yes.
Thank you. TG, the two presentations, they look much more smaller. If you can run through it so that members can take them as a right.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think the first one is a matter relating to the litigation management in the department. We have provided an Excel spreadsheet because it was quite difficult to consolidate everything in this presentation, and I hope members please receive the consolidated Excel document. Chair, just this is a very short presentation dealing with the nature of litigation that the department primarily faces by the way of application and which is notice of motions, and also the action proceedings, which is the summons that we receive. Just to explain, that the two, this is when applicants approach the court on the notice of motion seeking of particular relief on an urgent basis, and this in some instances is in relation to the release from detention, for an example, or the demand to enter the Republic of South Africa. We have those cases where someone arrives at the airport already, we get a notice of motion, and it's prevalent at Oortam, for an example. We also have notices of motions dealing with the department, being compelled to make certain decisions around the applications in relation to visas and permanent residence. The third one, Honourable Chairperson, is the review of decisions which are not favourable to the applicants. Makes an application, you reject it, and then they take that particular matter to court. So in the Excel document, obviously, you will be able to see some of those cases that relates to the three categories I've mentioned. And then the next one is around action proceedings, where the plaintiff, in most instances, they seek damage against the department, again on various actions. This relates to alleged unlawful arrest and detention for those who are found to be illegal in the country, the disputes on tenders and commercial contracts, and then the motor vehicle accidents involving departmental vehicles. Then the third part is labor proceedings. Obviously, this deals with cases of against the employees of the department where there's misconduct. So those are the nature of litigation that we're faced in the department. Now, currently, when we're again making the presentation on the annual report, we talked about the issue of contingent liability that the department currently faces, which is in the tune of about 2 billion rand. We're saying that this, we're saying the potential liability that may occur depending on the outcome of an uncertain future event where the department loses against the civil claim or litigation against whether it's a contract. So as of the 4th of November, which was yesterday, our contingent liability was sitting just over 2 billion rand. And we're saying the contingent liability list of the department has been divided into the following categories, and each category with the following amount as of the 4th of November, adding up to this amount. Under immigration services, for example, we've got a section dealing with immigration. There's the contingent liability, there is about 698 million rand. Under civic services, the contingent liability is about 479 million rand. And then under tenders and contracts, the contingent liability is just over 800 million rand. And then there are other cases, as I said, motor vehicles, labor, and so forth. It's about 7.7. If you then look at specifically under contingent liability, to say in 17-18, for an example, you had about 1.9, so the contingent liability has been growing over the years. As I've indicated, that under core business, if you look at it together, both civics and immigration, is 1.1 billion rand, and then the 800 million under contracts and so on. So, Chair, I must emphasize the point here that the matters relating to civics and immigration, some of those obviously were able to close with when decisions are made on those particular applications, and then the matter falls off. But we've had huge challenges in relation to obviously the ones that relating to contracts, and there are a few of them where you have huge claims against the department in relation to those. Also, just some statistical analysis on the number of cases that you have received per annum. In 2017, we had about 2,493 cases against the department litigation. 2018 was 3.7. As we speak, in 2019, we're sitting at 3.3 cases, which is obviously reflects not the financial year, but the calendar year. The legal costs have increased considerably over the last 5 years compared to the previous years, where the legal fees will hardly exceed 5 million per year. And the main reason for the said increase are opportunistic litigation, which we have to deal with, particularly when people want to take cases pro bono for certain individuals who are either in detention centers for preparing them for deportation. So the delays in finalizing adjudication of applications for visas, permanent residence, and the permanent residence one is quite a popular one, because in most instances where people apply for permanent residence on the basis of relations of marriage to South African citizens, we will have to ensure that actually we have proof that that marriage is not a marriage of convenience. So in some instances, there's delays in that. That's why we are working on actually even increasing the period in which the application will be finalized, because the current 8 months, it is not practical based on the limitations from inspectorate that they must first give us the file that says this particular person actually is involved in a good faith spousal relation. And then obviously I've talked about the issue of the detention of illegal foreigners in Lindela, which is seen as also as a hunting ground for some of the illegal people. The other issue is that costs in these types of matters obviously are always awarded in against the department, where for example the courts would say that we should have adjudicated the application within 8 months, because obviously our service level agreement in terms of what we commit to the public is that 8 months is a turnaround time. It's easy to adjudicate permanent residence on the basis of critical skills, business investment, but when it comes to the basis of marriage of South African, those are kind of things that we need to So that's why in order for us to mitigate again, we need to review the time period that we communicate to the public. Where the costs are awarded in favor of the department, recovery is also always a challenge, because we need state attorneys to obviously to help us to prioritize the recovery, because we work through the state attorneys. Also, applicants in some of these cases do not have the funds to pay the states where they have lost against the state, so also the recovery of that particular money is a challenge, because some of the applicants claim to be indigent foreigners. In some instances, they are asylum seekers when they lose those cases. So the payment of legal fees is also through the agency arrangement with the Office of the State Attorney, where they pay the set legal fees, and then obviously they invoice the department, and then with the department settle those particular invoices with the Department of Justice. Chair, in a sense, as I said, the spreadsheet therefore provides the categorization of those specific cases on those four categories that we have explained, and I'm not sure then whether the Chair would want then to go specifically to that particular list that we have provided the committee, but we thought in a nutshell we should be able to give the sense of the litigation environment in the department. Thank you very much.
Next presentation.
Heated. I'm struggling to find the case.
We are struggling with 4IR.
No, it's quite old, because I'm using something more sophisticated than this.
Wait, just go down. The case is not moving.
Are you saying that the committee is an old thing?
No, Honorable Court, I'm not accusing the committee. Apparently, this belongs to this official of the Department of Home Affairs. Thank you very much, Chairperson. So we were asked that we bring a presentation in relation to the services that we receive from the Visa Facilitation Services at the Department of Home Affairs. So in the presentation, we just want to deal with what the current status, Chair, that in December last year, the department extended the service agreement with the VFS Global for a period of 24 months effective from the 1st of January this year, which will run until the end of December next year. The extension of the service agreement was legally provided under clause 11.2 of the agreement, which indicates that this agreement can be renewed by DHA upon request to VFS for prior to 16 months before the contract expires, and it provides for successive renewals of 36 months each or shorter periods, so it might be deemed necessary. So we then opted for a period of 24 months after much deliberations on that because there were issues that were raised by the committee at the time. So let me just then explain the factors that we considered when we were extending this particular contract. Is that we had to look at our internal environment and become realistic with ourselves, whether are we able to provide these particular services. Because maybe, if you would allow me just a minute, that in the past, prior to us utilizing VFS services, the applications for visas, whether in country or outside the country, outside the country they were done at the missions, inside the country they were done in our front offices, where you would have a desk dedicated to immigration, but not in all offices, in large offices and medium offices. And before all these changes that we've made, people who are applying for those permits and visas, the adjudication of those applications will be done at a local office, at that particular office where the application is done. Then the department picked up the huge issues relating to corruption that would happen. And we had immigration agents also were submitting this thing directly to those offices and then, you know, getting into acts of corruption with some of the officials. The department then took a decision to centralize adjudication at head office and said that those offices, all they needed to do was to collect applications and then send them to head office for adjudication. We saw a lot of applications that were lost in transit, mainly because there was no longer an incentive. You know, particularly even for those agents who were, you know, having collusive arrangements with officials. Then post to that, because of the huge applications that were lost, the department then took a decision that the same model that we had implemented in 2010, because the VFS arrangement was implemented first abroad, because also in countries abroad, and in big countries like your China and India and many other countries, there were huge complaints that when people wanting to come to South Africa, they have to travel thousands and thousands of kilometers to go and apply. Like in China, we're only present in Shanghai and Beijing. And being a country that is as big as the continent in some, people who travel 2,000 kilometers, that is why we then opted the model, because we looked at what other countries are doing. We found that other countries are actually doing, utilizing that particular model. I mean, in the UK on its own, we've been able to operate now more than three centers that are even in the north of the UK where the machine is not there. So there's many other areas where we're able to, and I'll explain that in the following slide. So that's the one issue that led us to take this particular model. Once we implemented it in June 2014, there were huge benefits because since then, we've not lost applications. Because at the time when VFS takes an application, they convert that application to an electronic. We even receive it electronically. There's no person who could say the form has been lost in transit. The only original that we receive from VFS is it's a file for archives. But the actual application of every individual when we adjudicate, it's electronic. So that has actually reduced the incidence of lost documents to zero. So I thought I must just mention that particular point. So that's what we consider there. It's Visa Facilitation Services. Yes. So when we then extended last year, we then said that we wanted the extension, you know, allowed us an opportunity to proceed with the development of our long-term solution, which is the new biometric movement control system at ports of entry, which obviously interfaces with the e-visa. The projects have been the priority, and as of the October, the concept was ready, and the development was finalized. We were able to demonstrate it to the president. We are the two systems, which is movement biometric movement control system and e-visa, are independent system, but they operate in synergy to render efficient frontline services. Chairperson, you know, it's a pity that the committee, when they visited us at the time, we were not ready to show the demonstration. And given, you know, the opportunity, we would like to invite the committee, you know, to be able to demonstrate how the e-visa and the PMCS will work. Because what happens is that when someone has applied on the e-visa platform, we adjudicate, and then they get a letter that you can proceed to the port of entry, and then at the port of entry, the new BMC has the movement control system. That's where the e-visa is. The immigration official is able to pull out the visa on the screen to be able to see that this person actually has the digital or the electronic visa on the system. So that has been that has worked very well for us in this instance. Also, the issues that we considered was based on what VFS presented were the following, that if we were to extend with their contract on a month-to-month basis, as previously recommended by the committee, they had some infrastructure and operational commitments which they needed to commit to, because they have about 18 countries, they have 42 visa application centers which are used by us. So this requires obvious extensive administration over the lease agreements and administrative costs, which are also susceptible to global market fluctuations. So the DHA considered that comparable operations at a like-for-like for industry would normally be negotiated for a period of around 36 months minimum up to 60 months maximum. But then VFS obviously considered that you could do that for a period of 24 months. But also I want to indicate that the Home Affairs, we consider that any extension will require obvious VFS to undertake medium-term commitment and incur further capital investment against fixed-term and rental and lease agreements to provide and make allowable reasonable period, which for them will make them obvious viable for a period of 24 months, which we deem to be minimum, at which settlement could be reached. Because at that point, they were saying that month-to-month will kill the business. Secondly, that they were not going to be able to assist us. But also, they wanted to go for maximum. We said, look, as per the instruction of the committee, it was difficult for us, to push them for a period of 24 months, because we needed, obviously, to take a different route in this regard. As Home Affairs, also, we gave due consideration to the following before we extended the VFS. One was that the services rendered by VFS in support of the department's frontline operations, particularly in missions abroad, is integral to sustained efficiencies gained in the management of permitting and visa applications. Such efficiency supports our role in contributing to economic stimulus package and facilitation of immigration to South Africa. Secondly, the reputational risk to the department would be immense should there be a discontinuity in the operating model, both in country and global, and any change in the service must allow a seamless transition from one business partner to the other instead of an abrupt end of service. Also, winding down of such global expansive footprint would require intensive planning and coordination across stakeholders to ensure that the services offered to the public do not incur a disruption. DHA does not have current capacity, either human resources level nor in respect of its system, to readily implement an alternative business process to the existing business partnership developed over time with VFS, especially with reference to automated end-to-end electronic management system progressively instituted at this particular center since 2014. This map just demonstrated some of the countries that we currently have a footprint of these visa application centers in 18 countries globally. And then there's then we'll explain the 45 centers where they are located, because in certain countries like India, there's 9 of those particular centers. The table here just also shows that particular center. So in India, for an example, we've got 9 centers. If we look at those 9 centers, they've generated in 2018 71,000 applications. As we speak, as of end of August, it was at 51,000. In Nigeria, last year, we collected over 101,000 applications. As we speak, we're sitting at 32,000 at the end of August. So this shows that, at some point in Nigeria, we're getting over 300 applications. Part of the issues that were raised by the AG at the time was that, yes, you are able to take more applications because of VFS, but, the adjudication, so it was like a funnel. So more applications at top, but we are not able to process. So that's why we needed to put more capacity in those machines. Not that there was a problem in relation to the operations of VFS, but there was a problem in the adjudication in that regard. And then obviously this also explains, to say that in total last year, over 390,000 applications were processed through that process. Again, if you look at the capacity of the of our machines, whether they can be able to process these applications, it's another question. The department's supply chain management process was also observed prior to the extension of the contract with VFS in last year.
We had an ad hoc bid education committee meeting which we convened on the 12th of December to consider the request for approval for the extension of the VFS. And there were obvious certain issues that were resolved at the BAC which relating to support the recommendation for the extension of the contract for a period of 24 months, obviously subject to the certain conditions to say business unit, which is permitting unit, must submit to the BAC the PPP project plan, submit quarterly progress report against the PPP project plan. It was at the time we had obtained a legal advice that we need to actually go through a PPP process and get a same type service, but must do it through a PPP, not through a bidding process, so that with the PPP you are able to expand the mandate and the role of this particular service provider. They can even do more for us to be able to get value for money. And then there were other conditions relating to registering the PPP with National Treasury, which have all that since been undertaken. There was also a need for us to consult with the service providers, I've indicated, to say through the consultation we had engaged the VFS management, and then the various short-term options were explored. They indicated that since the inception of the project, they've made a huge investment in the establishment of centers. For example, when New Zealand hit us with the visa requirement a few years back, we obviously had reciprocated at the time, as discussed with the DECO. So we had to set up a facility in New Zealand, and then they did it within a short period of time, and many other countries where we did it. So we acceded, therefore, to the request for 24 months. So moving forward, in terms of implementing the PPP, the current actions of the Department of Yes are aligned to the recommendations received from National Treasury in 2018, confirming that they are in agreement with the comments of the Auditor General that the current contract of visa facilitation service should be a PPP, and that National Treasury added a recommendation that DHA should develop technical specification in order to first publish the request for information, which will invite stakeholders to submit an expression of interest and such service on behalf of the department. And then the resolution 2 was that of the letter received from Treasury stated that the Home Affairs should consider going out on a tender to request for information to test for the market for an appropriate procurement method, and the results thereof be shared with the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer. So testing the market implies DHA may want to proceed with the appointment of another service provider should the RFI yield positive responses. However, this is not a precondition to the outcome of the RFI, and the replacement of the current service provider is not exclusive to the specification. So basically what it means is that the expectation was that we needed obviously to call for requests for information on the service providers that we could contract for the purposes of PPP, and then after that the PPP process could then start. Then the next part just deals with where we are in terms of the e-visa and the PMCS, which I think I talked about at the beginning, so I'd like to jump this particular slide. So in conclusion, Chair, we're saying the modernization program itself of the department presents a new challenge to us. It is anticipated that the introduction of the e-visa obviously will reduce the extent and of dependency the DHA has on the business, permitting business partner like VFS, for example, to render support operation. But it should be assumed that in future, the services required by the permitting business will not be the like for like with the current VFS operations. It will probably be scaled down, that the footprint could also be diminished in the face of successful e-visa program. And also this potentially reduces the scope of future partnership, and the service provider will likely be confronted with a decision on how to scale its operation according to the reduced demands, you know, in light of the e-visa rollout. And for us, Chairperson, it is clear that any PPP process that we are currently busy now will not be concluded by the time the contract reach expiration on the 31st of December 2020. A realistic expectation is that the PPP will take an average of 36 to 48 months for such a PPP to conclude. We have learned this, for example, with the current PPP process with the bank, it just passed 2 years, you know, and it was a PPP that was established on the basis of the work that we had already done, but it has taken longer than we expected. So that's a challenge that we are currently faced with. But I must also emphasize that on the issue relating to this type of service of the lack of VFS, we also, even though we have the e-visa that is being implemented, the long-term permits like your study visa, your spousal visa, your permanent resident visa. Those at this point in time will not be processed through the e-visa. The e-visa is going to deal with short-term tourist visas. I think we need to emphasize the point. Mm-hmm. Hence, obviously, we still need this kind of service moving forward, but obviously we'll have to do it on the triple P process, not on the BID process, so that, as I said, we can expand the work that they can do. Because currently, for example, they cannot do adjudication. They only collect the applications and then send to us so that we can be able to adjudicate. Obviously, there's other activities that they can do once they're on the triple P, conduct proper due diligence on the application, the completeness, and all the other related functions that they can be able to help us with. So I thought I should just, you know, give that particular context that the e-visa, we said we are rolling it out for a period at least of 2 years, we'll just be dealing with tourist visas, which are short-term. Long-term, we still need this other vehicle to process them because the capacity of it needs to be built over a period of time. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you. Members?
I think one last issue that we need to brief the committee about is that these services actually do not, the Department of Home Affairs does not carry any financial obligation towards payments. Thank you.
Honorable Ross and then Honorable McLover and then Honorable Kanyile. Honorable Van der Merwe, Honorable Tito, Honorable Likota, and Honorable Chabane.
Thank you, Chair. I think the committee puts a lot of faith in us. I think we received about 6 presentations yesterday afternoon / evening to go through all of these different issues. So we're going to try our best to deal with this volume of information that we have to work through. There seems to be about 4 of these cases in the contingent liabilities that is almost, if I look at it, there's a 420 million rand case in immigration, 400 in civics, 602 million in tenders, and 171 million in tenders as well. So that's about 1.5 billion on 4 cases. So I just want to ask about those cases in particular, if we can just understand. So I don't know if I have to point out where they are, or you're probably familiar with them, they're so big. Okay. So if you can just explain to us the reason for such a big value of those and what specifically is happening with those. Then there was a report by the African Center of Migration and Society on these high court reviews. And what they said is that why these cases are being lost is because there's not a proper or a rational decision-making process that is visible. So when somebody applies to an RSDO and they put a report there, so what they do is they'll take some cut and paste from some other report, put that as a reason, and some of those reasons are not even related to the case. So my question there is there a rational decision-making process that the RSDOs go over? And then I believe it's important just to say that it's extremely disappointing that we only log cases and we don't actually log whether they were lost and why they were lost. Because it's 2 billion rand and then you don't even know if you won it or lost it, number one. And number two, you don't know why. So how on earth are you going to fix the problems that create these cases? Then in terms of the next presentation, we talk about the biometric movement control system. In the previous presentations, it was shown that until we have a three-tier data system or data center, then this thing's not going to be feasible. So what is the time frame? Based on that constraint, again, it seems to be from CETA, if we need to have this tier three data center up and running, before we can even start looking at implementing the biometric movement control system, what are the kind of time frames that we're looking at there? Then in terms of the visa facilitation services in specific, so my first question there is why did it take a whole year to get to a point where we just have an expression of interest document. Because it was October 2018 already where that instruction was given. It's November now. Now we're talking about an expression of interest. So why did that take over a year? My next question is that there's allegations of exorbitant pricing that people are paying to apply for a visa through visa facilitation services, like thousands of rands. So my question to you is what percentage of that fee that visa facilitation services is taking actually comes back to South Africa? Because my understanding is that VFS is an international company. Does all that revenue stay there? What percentage of that fee comes back to South Africa? And then finally, in our legacy report, it talks of an investigation into alleged irregularities with the visa facilitation services tender. So my question there is if we can understand what is the status of that investigation.
Thank you. Let's follow each other in that sequence. Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to raise a few concerns on the legal aspect as reported. We are all aware that we have received compulsory cuts, and if you look at the amount being mentioned in terms of liability, it's 2 billion. We receive for the year 18-19 an amount of 7.9 billion. So almost a half of that goes to our legal fraternity, and I would want to know how will this affect this department in the future. And you know, the some of the allegations, luckily not me, Chairperson, some of the allegations is that Home Affairs takes its time to fix legislation, especially when it comes to compliance in terms of various legislations. And even the court has described the department as floppy, shocking, obstructive, and especially when it comes towards refugees and asylum seekers. I've been at the UN office here in Cape Town last week, and there were almost 100 people arrested, and it was very difficult to find one officer of Home Affairs there. I was actually happy and lucky, because if there was arrest by the Home Affairs officials, we would have more legal cases. So we also admit, Jefferson, that the Home Affairs operate under legal constraints and also staff. But I would argue that, you know, those billions could have been utilized better in employing perhaps more people, because you'll find at the end of the day that the very same staff, you know, they have to deal with legal matters when it comes back to the department as well. And then perhaps if the department can also just speak to that, might be a solution to our problem, if the deputy minister can also speak us to the events in around Moatapile project, because when it was announced, you know, I was very interested in seeing, because it seems to be a vehicle that can also assist when it comes to this. So it is a concern, the billions that we are utilizing, and also the allegations and court outcomes on the take on Home Affairs when it comes to legal cases. There must be a plan from Home Affairs. How are we going to deal with it?
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to refer to the contingent liability list and focus more on the civic services that has an amount of about 479 million. The question that I have to the department, I want to know that what exactly are they doing to ensure
that we don't end up with such cases. Why I am asking this question, I have a case that was reported to me by Lindy with CBC. She's from Johannesburg. Apparently in 2002, she applied for an ID, and when she went to collect the ID, she was given a death certificate. After going to the Home Affairs offices many a times to try and get this matter resolved, it was only resolved after 11 years. So basically this woman was declared dead for 11 years. So what took the department 11 years to actually finally resurrect her? Because eventually after 11 years, he was finally resurrected. Now, another issue that she is having, when she's having two kids, because now she was dead, she requested the husband to go and apply for the birth certificate for her two kids. Apparently, they put the wrong year of birth on that birth certificate. And it is different from the records that they have on the school card or school report. Now, these kids, they can't even apply for job, because when they go to apply, you are carrying a matric certificate that says you were born in 1997, and you are carrying an ID that says you were born in 1996. She is saying she has been to the Home Affairs offices many, many, many times, and she has not been assisted. Instead, somebody told her to go and see a lawyer so that they can resolve her case. The only reason I think she called, and she was crying, like literally crying, is because she could not afford the 3,500 rands for the consultation fee. So I seriously want to know what took the department, or why it took them 11 years. Another case that I have, which may be of a similar nature, I'm going to try to read this one from my notes because I've never heard of such a case before. Like I've indicated before that I went to Gwamhlabuya Lingana. The case that I found there was a young lady, I think she's still a teenager. The Induna was speaking on her behalf, indicating that her father passed away at home. So when she passed away, this was around August this year, when he passed away, they didn't have money to bury him and the money to take him to the doctor so that the doctor can certify him dead. So they digged a hole at home and called Induna to come and actually see that the man is dead. And after digging the hole, they put him inside there. Apparently, they are saying the procedure is that after that, they must go to the Induna and get a certain documentation that the Induna will complete, and then they will take it to Home Affairs so that the Department of Home Affairs can issue them with a death certificate. So they followed that procedure, but when they got to the Home Affairs offices, they were told that they are not going to give them a death certificate until that person has been certified dead by a doctor. Even though they tried to explain that they did not take him to the doctor because apparently the only person that is surviving in that family is this young girl I'm talking about. So she didn't have money to hire transport to take the body to the doctor and did not even have money to bury him. So as a result, she is sitting without her father's death certificate, and she does not even have a birth certificate as well, because apparently she will need the father's death certificate to be able to apply for her birth certificate. If you can just assist us and tell us how do you normally deal with these cases, so that in future when you come across such issues, we can be able to give proper guidance. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. DG, I saw the DG last week here in Cape Town speaking to ENCA about just after the attacks between foreigners and police officials here in the Western Cape, where those who are seeking refuge and asylum were asked to be repatriated back to other countries. But they said they don't want to go back to their own countries. They want to be sent to Europe and America and all those things. So I would really like to, the issue of the legal fees and the amount of money we are spending on these cases, I would agree with the Honourable McClure that at the end of the day, I think the problem arises. We've got a crisis in terms of the delay period in adjudicating or coming to a decision around these asylum-seeking applications. And then we are wasting a lot of money that could actually have been plunged back into creating a bigger department dealing with these cases. Because I sort of feel that we, you know, we've said it before, I don't think you've got enough personnel or staff to deal with the volume of cases that you have to deal with. And so I was wondering in terms of, because you speak about the main reasons for the increase in the legal fees and then some of the challenges, but I wondered whether at one point shouldn't we engage Treasury, or even shouldn't you look at beefing up the amount of staff and resources to deal with the number of cases that you have to deal with? Because I see after the attacks on our law enforcement officials, or the attacks between the refugees and law enforcement officials here in the Western Cape, the Amnesty International is now on record saying that our refugee and asylum-seeking system, the entire system, is broken. And they're saying that there's 50,000 more pending asylum-seeking cases, which probably will again result in more litigation. So I'm thinking, at what stage do we start saying that we don't have enough resources and personnel, and that we should be increasing the volume of people that deal with these cases? Because it feels to me like we are working backwards and not forwards. And so that this money could have been better spent on maybe increasing our resources to deal with these cases. But I guess that is just a comment, Chairperson. At the end of the day, we are losing money that should be spent elsewhere. Thank you.
Honourable Court. Honourable Chaban.
Honourable Kota.
No, Chair, I did not raise my hand yet. But I'm happier to make an observation in a moment or two.
I was just respecting seniority. Honourable Chaban.
No, thanks, Chair. That on the contingent liability, just to get to the DG, I see here there's others of 7.7 million, which you have, and now that you're reporting to us, I think it will be important also to just take into confidence on the what constitutes these others, so that we're able to work on the details that are from the department. And one of the areas which I wanted to check with the department, on these issues which are raised, is there any other route to do, consider settlement out of court on some of the areas that I think need to be dealt with the department. The second point is on this thing of the VFS, the veterans asking what is it is. Your report, I think one of the issues which is explaining, is raising here, it's a human resource capital, where you don't have capacity. And I think the DG in the period since this VFS has been contracted to the department, what were the measures that have to be implemented by the department to capacitate and respond to the internal human resource? And I think it's one area that I think, because if it has to completely withdraw, it will suggest that the country is going to be in chaos. If this company has to tomorrow has to withdraw its services to the department, does it suggest that the country will be in chaos because we have not able to create mechanism to upskill our people to respond to what the services is rendering? What are the transitional periods now that you have extended the this VHS in terms of when it's going to be the implication that may exist if this company is going to be not continue to put service to the department? Honorable Ross is correct that there's an expression from the previous committee that there were
investigation that we've been directed by the department to investigate, in line with how this company, this service provider has been provided. I think the DG may need to highlight some of the areas that I think have been taken to. We may not necessarily deal with the issues on the its standing now as a VHS, but I think the DG may need to take the committee into confidence on the issues that arise from the previous committee of the investigation. I think the other issue which has been raised by Ross is that this company has been doing work throughout the world. I'm looking at your map here and the countries that they've been involved. Was there any benchmark of any of the companies that are existing in the country which can put the same services in future with the department if you had to consider bringing other companies in the system? But Chair, I think we may need to take conscience in terms of looking on what they've done, this company, what are the implications if this VHS has to be collapsed now, and so to assist complement the work of the of government, noting the issues that have been raised by the previous committees and also members in relation to its activities. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, thank you. We're left with about 10 minutes. I'm going to allow you to respond, but we need to zero in on the issues. One observation I have is that, you know, when we come to Parliament or when we do reports to Parliament, we think that we're just doing it to finish, you know, pretty gala, which is not what I think it should be. Because when we come to Parliament, part of what we want in Parliament is to get further ideas, further wisdom on how to execute the issues as we get back to Pretoria. It should be the attitude. The attitude shouldn't be, no, let's just give the information. Because our attitude is to assist government and the executive to do things better and in the interest of the electorate. With regard to the cases, I think the categorization must also tell us that how much have we spent against the amount? Because you must still pay lawyers to go to court. So how much have... Because you may find that you are spending almost the same amount that you are still going to go to court for. But in terms of the new development in the law fraternity is that we have what we call alternative dispute resolution. Mm. Alternative dispute resolution. It shouldn't be that when there is a case, people have a dispute with us, we just say, no, let's go to court. There must be a deliberate attempt from government to check the merits of this case and to check all other issues. But why the matter keeps on coming here, Honorable Deputy Minister and members, is the Auditor General said in the next round of audit, which it has started, they're going to be now qualifying the department on the basis of these cases, because they're going to get inside the case one by one and check what is it that we're exactly doing, or anything that is a frustration, you just pile it to the legal and it gets to court and we have this contingent, this big contingent liabilities. So what we had in mind when we said let's deal with this matter is that let's categorize them. As it relates to contract, let's check those that we can deal with them in terms of alternative dispute resolution, those that we can pay, those that we can go to court for, they arrive for court specifically, because that will be important. I made mention of a case last time that the people claimed about 6 million rand. The lawyers were paid about 400,000. Ultimately, it was negotiated and dealt with, and it was settled at 1 million. Do you see the amounts, the disparities of the amounts vis-a-vis what we have already spent and so on? So we could get into into alternative dispute resolution, and we will try to resolve a lot of these cases, because some of the cases, if you, it's just misunderstanding. Some of the cases about dates and so on. But if you just, you don't just pack everything there. Because if we were to pay this 2 billion, then it means the department will be insolvent. So we must look into those issues and be very creative. It's not like we want this information to either penalize or what. We want to be creative and to progressively deal with the problems of litigation, because as Honorable Van der Merwe says, that one of last week, it will attract another litigation. But if we have alternative dispute resolution processes, we will progressively deal with problems. And I think the when questions are raised and comments, it's not like the department must now come defend. The intention is not like it's a, you are in a game of rugby where you push, you push. It's about, it's why a complementary structure that must assist you do your work better. And we want to be viewed as such at all material terms. I think you will answer the questions specifically. But with regard to the second one of VFS, I have seen that what you are raising, Honorable Ross. But from where I'm sitting, I think it will be a sad day when the Parliament, the Committee of Parliament sits and decide to adjudicate tenders in the department and say, this one, give it to this, this one to this, cancel this one, we don't know. I think it's bothering. It's bothering overreaching in terms of oversight. So the Committee of Parliament sits and say, go and cancel this thing. I think we're bothering overreaching in terms of how we need to do the oversight. So carefully so. And what the department is presenting today, I think if there is a lapse on a contract and we can't do it in the next, we will not be able to do it in the next 3 years, what we must say is that department, do whatever is in your power administratively and in the legal framework of the Public Finance Management Act to make sure that the services, particularly this service that we are speaking about, the President has been very clear. The Minister of Finance says, this issue of visa, it's hampering with economic growth. What do we need to do then? The department needs to make sure that it puts every system in place to attract these tourists, because we are told by both the President and the Minister of Finance that we are getting less economic growth on the basis that the visas are not properly adjudicated. And the department said there is a lack of staff. So if the issue of VFS, we have followed all the laws, we have done everything in terms of the laws, make it to assist the country to attract more tourists, make us as the country to respond to what we have already said, that we need the economy to grow and tourism is part of it. So Home Affairs must not hamper that service. And it must give certainty to those people who are doing their work. It must not be like this previous presentation that we got here, Honorable Court, wherein there is lax. If the decisions are correct, take decisions. And Parliament, where we have taken right decisions, it will say, this is a correct decision. Where we have taken wrong decisions, Parliament will say, no, this is the wrong decision, we have not followed the law, and so on. So give certainty. If that VFS, which has set up every structure, make sure that give them certainty. Give them time to do this thing so that you allow your P, your triple P. But if you're going to say, you know, month to month, once you know that this thing will take 54 months, then you come and report to Parliament, then it gives a problem. Why can't you give them the whole MTF and put your systems properly and tell Parliament, this is what we've done, we'll live by this decision, and we think we're correct, than to do things on an ad hoc basis, because those ad hoc basis things, they attract these corrupt tendencies and corrupt things that we have picked up in the previous presentation. But I want to allow you to quickly respond with an intention of accepting that the committee is assisting you to do your job better.
Chair, thank you very much. I'd like to start with just with a specific matter that I need to respond to, because the issue of capacity keeps on rising and what is it that we are doing and so forth. Chair, there's a letter that I would share with the honorable members, two letters that I'd like to share. The first one is a letter I wrote on the 29th of April, of March this year to National Treasury, which I'd like just to quickly go through a few parts of it. It was the request to National Treasury to increase the compensation of employees ceiling for the Department of Home Affairs in order to support the Presidential Economic Stimulus Package and facilitate tourism from China and India. Then in that letter, we explained the budgetary constraint the department is faced with, the limited presence at missions abroad. In this regard, we say the department deployed 42 officials in 33 missions, so we're explaining that. We then also explained that, you know, over the last few years, how many posts we have lost. To say in 16-17, we lost 688 posts of value 220 million. Further, 430 posts were abolished in 2017-18, and so forth. So we explained all those particular issues, and we said we need an increase of about 60 million rand in our COE in order for us to be able to increase the capacity in the missions abroad, in order for us to deal with additional capacity. So that letter went on the 29th of March. Okay. Here's the response from National Treasury on the 4th of October 2019. In the letter of October, it's now responding to that issue of March and to another letter we had also submitted about the increase in the COE, which letter we also submitted on the 15th of July. The letter says, and it's a letter that's now being written by a DDG to me, having written to a DG. It says, your letter dated 15 July has reference. When we said received on the 5th of September has reference. National Treasury has assessed your request to shift 130 million from goods and services to compensation of employees in order to increase capacity in foreign missions and in the information technology division. The request for the increase in the compensation of employees expenditure is not in line with the government long-term strategic goal of changing the composition of government expenditure away from compensation of employees towards capital infrastructure spending. Therefore, the National Treasury would like to inform the department that the request to shift funds amounting from 70 million from goods and services to compensation of employees is not approved. However, the request of 60 million with respect to foreign increasing capacity in foreign missions require that the department put together a business case detailing what detailing the cost benefit analysis of making such an investment. The department is requested to resubmit the request of the 60 million together with the business case in order for National Treasury to reconsider. So I'm raising this thing just to demonstrate these are some of the efforts we have made where we have constrained. I think Honorable Van der Bevel raises a very important issue around capacity in certain areas to take decisions, whether it's an asylum seeker decision and so forth. But the issue that at every point where we're trying to increase capacity and say that we understand that the fiscus, you know, is constrained, so rather cut from the goods and services money and be able to get more personnel to do this job. Because, Chairperson, it doesn't help me to have money for goods and services, but I don't have people to work. In other words, that capital in infrastructure expenditure does not give me, I will have the money for projects, but I don't have money for people to work on projects. I'm not sure whether you get. So this is the issue of the challenge. Obviously, with the reorganization of government, there's been an indication that Home Affairs might get staff that will transfer from other departments in order to increase the capacity. So it's a process that has not yet unfolded. So I thought I should just mention that particular issue. Then let me quickly deal with the issue of the question that have been raised around the quoted liability, which the Honorable Rosa said. Look, when you look at the nature and the size of the department with a contingent liability of 2 billion rand, in as much as we want to have probably a zero contingent liability, but I think in the days we live in, everybody has a right to institute any litigation against the state at any given time because they are not satisfied with. So we can't prevent people instituting that particular litigation. The question is what the NMDCA raises to say, how do we then deal with dispute resolutions? As I said, say, in some of the instances where the case is either in application to court, for people to go to court, we try and resolve the issue relating to a decision. For example, a decision on the adjudication of an asylum seeker permit or adjudication on the permanent resident permit. We try and mitigate those if they have not reached the court, because some of the lawyers obviously will come to us. But it also goes back to the capacity. If I can show you, as I'm sitting here, that I've just seen in my email, there's been about 4 matters that have just arrived while I'm sitting here. So sometimes some of these matters, depending when they arrive and who deals with them, they sometimes they fall through the cracks and then they end up finding themselves in court. The second issue is the rational decision making. The RSDOs, I must be honest, we train them on a regular basis. We even give them what we call country of origin reports, which we do on a quarterly basis, which informs the refugee status determination officers. So that I don't use acronyms, Honorable God. Refugee status determination officers, these are the officials who are at first hand. They receive the case of someone who's claiming asylum, and then they see where the person is coming from. You know, they make a decision on the basis of the country report. If someone is not able to show that they are being persecuted and so forth, because then we are not able to grant an asylum, you know, refugee status, because there is no claim. You know, someone will come and say, yes, in the newspaper, for example, the government has threatened me because I'm a homosexual person, I'm this particular person. So some of the evidence that supports that, we're even able to draw on our own to say, this person says I'm coming from country X, you know, there's been issues relating to my religious belief, and then those particular cases. But in the most cases, even the people themselves, they come and just tell you that, no, I'm seeking asylum. Why are you seeking asylum? Are you being persecuted? So it says, no, I'm looking for a job. Already, that particular person, the case is gone down the water. You know, you cannot then take that particular case forward. On the issue of PMCS, the Honorable Ross, the issue of PMCS we were raising was around the network, to say that we need to host it in the network that is 99.9 available, in order for a port of entry not to be what we call offline during a very peak period and so forth. But what we have done to mitigate that particular issue for now, while CDS is resolving its network problem, we've done what we call a local server synchronization. So meaning that at every point where we put the PMCS, we'll have to put a server. So that will allow us to process offline. And then we synchronize on the server so that when the network is up, then we... But it's not an ideal situation, because remember, you must also be able to pick up the hits to say this person is prohibited and so forth. So that's a mitigating strategy that we are going to use by putting the server to do local synchronization and allow an offline mode. I'll ask my colleagues, I think Richard, to deal with why it took a year for the expression of interest on the issue of VFS. And the allegations of exorbitant prices, it is not true. The amount of VFS, for example, they cannot increase the application fee without us approving that. They have not increased the amount. It's about 1,350 that they charge per application. It's a standard fee that in most countries, I mean, you go to the UK, you pay 7,000 rand to a VFS type, they use TLS. There's many of those type of organizations that they utilize. So if you look at globally, the amount of evidence, it happens when someone, let's say they submit an incomplete application. Let's say if I reject the permanent resident application, then the person wants to appeal. He must pay another 1,350 at any given point. So those are the only amount that VFS charges the foreign nationals who are utilizing these particular services. On the investigation regarding the tender, we came to the committee last year, We presented the processes, the tender process that was followed in 2010 when the tender was done for out of the country, also that was done with in country. We explained when it was advertised, who were the bidders. We gave all that particular information to the committee, which we can resubmit. There was a process that was followed, which was a proper tender process. There were local, actually, companies that bidded with VFS. But unfortunately, they never had a footprint in terms of ability to provide this particular service. Obviously, when it has to go out to get to the market, I think there was a question that was asked whether we were considering other local companies in order to do the same work with benchmark. I think Honorable Chabane raised the issue. Yes, obviously we did that benchmarking through a tender process. We issued a tender, the local companies, I think there were three of the companies that responded. So we can be able to avail those particular documents to demonstrate that that process was quite open, but VFS was actually above them because they already had a global footprint, and there was evidence of their work that has been done. Honorable Maglua, on the issue relating to UNHCR, we did not go there deliberately because I was very clear, even in the what Honorable Van der Merwe raised in the interview that I did, was that we met with the people who were demonstrating in Pretoria with South African Human Rights Commission on the 21st of October. They were very clear that they don't want to talk to Home Affairs. They just want to be taken out of the country. I also made an effort myself. We wrote to them last Monday requesting a meeting on Wednesday here in Cape Town. They said they don't want to have any engagement with us. Because what we had wanted with them, we said, we want to know, you are saying that you are asylum seekers. Let's see who is an asylum seeker in that group, who is a refugee, so that you can be able then to give a clear picture. Chairperson, there are people who declare themselves asylum seekers without having visited a single refugee reception office. It's self-declaration. And this is when the NGOs, then they go and claim that Home Affairs is not assisting, is not documenting this particular individual. Chair, if you're an asylum seeker, there is no person who can claim that they're an asylum seeker that they have never been documented. An asylum seeker at any given time will be documented at least once in their time, where they arrive and given Section 22. When they are now failed asylum seekers, we can't document them further because they need to be either voluntarily leave the Republic or they are a case for deportation. So it can't be correct, therefore, that we refuse to we have every individual who says he's an asylum seeker has been given a document before. That one who says does not have a document was what we call self-determined and self-declared. And then, Honorable Kanyile, I think we need to deal with those specific cases, but let me tell you, respond to them, Klabialing and Ahmed. There is a process which is part of our SOPs, how we deal with the case of registering death, where the doctor, who's a medical officer, must certify that the person has passed on. And it is a problem because if we don't follow that process, this is where someone will arrive at Home Affairs and say, my father has died, so-and-so has died. And then because we can't be emotional about these issues, because if we are emotional, we will then declare a person dead while they are alive, because the daughter appeared at our doorstep with an induna who cannot be held accountable. We have situations where when we do late registration of birth, you know, some people are actually, even school principals, get to issue reports that are fake, you know, in support of a matter that this child was here in the school. There were two cases in Ladysmith, for an example, that counter-corruption was dealing with, where two Zimbabwean children were registered by two sisters who were siblings, who were registered these children as their own. They even were able in the report to show that these children attended school while they were stealing identities of their own children. So these are some of the matters that we have to deal with. So we need to be able to have a matter certified. That is why public hospitals will be there for that, so that they can be able to access. I do understand that in far-flung remote areas where medical facilities are not available, but we are very, very, very wary of just taking somebody's word, particularly if it's post-burial, because we must also take a fingerprint, a footprint of that footprint of that particular person who has died, so that tomorrow, when there's a question that this person actually has not died, we are able to produce records that said no, with this there was an evidence that the thumbprint of this particular person was taken. So we need to find a different way of how do we help this person to deal with, because it's quite a very sensitive area. Hence, that Lindy might have been a similar case where she has been reported dead, either for insurance, you know, claimed by certain individuals, if not herself, because again, when people come in, then I just want to
thank you, TG.
Yes,
thank you, TG. I think we're running out of time. Some of these questions, I request that you write them to us. Your answers, give them in writing. Honorable Lizelle, you want to say something?
No, maybe I'll leave it to when we discuss as a committee on some of the issues, because I wanted to say at one point we as a committee will also have to engage Treasury because I think the letter that the Honourable DG read has given me a lot of insight into some of the issues. So I think at one stage we will also have to intervene in terms of engagements with Treasury on a way forward and with regards to the resources, challenges, personnel.
No, thank you. Before I give the Honourable Deputy Minister to do the closing, I think with regard to this two presentation, I think maybe the department must go further to deal with this categorization with an intention of trying to resolve these matters in a more open way that would assist. I'm sure in the next session the matter will also arise again. But let's further categorize these cases and know that these are the cases so that we know which one can be dealt with as part of the ATR process. With regard to the second one, I think do your triple P and check the months that will get your triple P in order. But in the meantime, extend the scope with certainty of these people who are assisting you to provide services in the country. DM.
No, thank you, Chair. I think we do accept the wisdom of the committee around issues of litigation and the advice that we are finding in terms of packaging them and then finding a way of resolving them, looking at each specific case. I think that will do. The second issue, Chair, is that I will request for all members of the committee that in instances where they come across queries, they do refer them to our parliamentary liaison offices so that we can be able to give facts and try to assist together with the department. I think that will go a long way so that we don't always, when we meet, we are always dealing with new cases. But we know very well that as and when cases come up, we deal with them. Because sometimes there's a lot of misinformation when people report, and as such, you know, it creates a wrong perception. And I think we are willing to help. The issue of staffing, Chair, remains one of our greatest problems that we had reported, and I'm happy that the DG has also brought to light to the committee in terms of the letters that have been written to Treasury Department. But in the meantime, we are also trying to make amends with what we have. For instance, if you look at our outreach and our responsibility to attracting more tourists, if we do not have the measures that we have with the full footprint of institutions like VFS, we'll really be struggling because we'll not be able to take more people and place them in motion in missions abroad. Even with the introduction of the e-visa, there are people who are going to need to capture their biometrics before they even arrive at the country. So if we do not have that particular service, it then collapses us. And I think it actually is helping us. And on the issue of the refugees, we are having a problem. There is a lot of, and I will really call for us to speak in one voice. There is general abuse of the asylum and refugee regime by economic migrants who come to the country and say they're economic migrants, knowing very well that they come and say they're asylum seekers, but they're actually economic migrants. And that is why we have even came up with the issue of the change of the regulations, DG, to allow for appeals to be processed quicker, because previously what has been happening is that appeals will have to have a quorum of three people, and that has been difficult. Now we are going to see these appeals being dealt with much speed with the introduction of these of these new regulations. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. You are released, members. I just want us to agree on how do we process the issue that we have left. I see time is not there. If possible, that we elevate it to the next meeting for a proper.
Minister.